or watching by means of cable television or internet streaming, you can access a copy of the agenda through our city website, atascadero.org. And I would ask the audience if you would be courteous enough to make sure that your cell phones are on, at least put them on the vibrate mode so that we don't have interruptions. Thank you, Jerry. And please join me as I lead the Pledge of Allegiance. We'll now move on to our roll call, although we do have a new addition to the city. And Marcia, would you like to introduce Suzanne?
Yes, thank you, Mayor Brendler. I just wanted to introduce Suzanne Anshin. She's going to be being the deputy city clerk and take the minutes to replace Grace, who we had for many years. And she'll be taking the role.
Well, welcome, Suzanne. You have a big pair of shoes to fill, Grace.
Yes, I do. Yes,
all righty. Well, please do the roll call.
Roll call. Councilmember Clay.
Yes.
Councilmember Luna.
Here.
Councilmember O'Malley.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Bayrou.
Here.
Mayor Brendler.
Here.
All present.
And thank you. All right, we'll now move on to approval of the agenda. And Mr. Frace, it's my understanding that the applicant is not prepared to move forward with item C1, the Walmart project, and the issues related to the EIR. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Mayor. We did receive a letter yesterday from the representatives for Walmart stores. They are asking for this item to be continued. We believed from previous meetings with Walmart this summer that they were intending to move ahead without the Rotman Group's annex project. They now want to reconsider that. It appears that the annex project and the Walmart project will be collaborating, so they need some more time to work through that coordination process.
All right, thank you. So as protocol is, we strike that from the agenda. Is that my understanding?
Correct.
All right. And I would propose that we also substitute item C3 that deals with the campaign finance ordinances. I would ask that we substitute that as the first management report, since there was an expectation by the public and consensus by this council that we pick up where we left off last meeting. Particularly that we address this issue at a reasonable hour. So I hope that we have consensus for that.
I mean, two isn't going to take much time at all. I don't quite understand why we're doing this.
I'm sorry, Jerry, I didn't
say item two is not going to take a lot of time, in my opinion. But.
Well, that's debatable. You never know. I think it would be appropriate to handle the campaign finance issues.
I'm okay with that.
I'm okay.
I would rather stick with the agenda. We have a major item cut. I think we're going to be expeditious and work through the agenda as it is.
Likewise.
I move to approve the agenda as amended by the mayor.
Second.
We have a motion by Mayor Pro Tem Bayrou, a second by Councilmember Luna. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Luna?
Yes.
Councilmember O'Malley?
No.
Councilmember Clay?
No.
Mayor Pro Tem Bayrou?
Yes.
Mayor Brendler?
Yes.
Motion passes 3-2.
Hey, Mike, I have a question for Warren in regards to the Walmart issue, if you don't
feel mind. Free. Go ahead.
So, Warren, what you're saying is that that Walmart and the Rotman Group now have decided to come back together and submit simultaneously, is that what you're saying?
Well, they've already both submitted applications. We were under the impression originally they were going to process them together. Over the summer, Walmart informed us that they wanted to move forward and Rotman Group didn't, so that's what we were going to discuss tonight. But it appears from the letter that we received yesterday that they intend to go back to the original plan to collaborate and work together on processing the project.
So I guess I can assume that that the Rotman Group probably contacted them and decided to...
Welcome, Chief.
Thank you, Mayor Brendler and members of the City Council. Kelly, would you come up, please?
This is one of the more important, or the most important, and the rewarding parts of my job is honoring two of our great employees. This is Kelly Reblo. Kelly is our support services technician, and she's being presented with the Chief of Police Award. Not only am I proud to be honoring one of our finest and well-respected dispatchers, but I'm also making this presentation on behalf of retired Police Chief John Couch, who was the Chief of Police at the time that this actual event occurred. And to give you some understanding of this, this was a San Luis Obispo County Narcotics Task Force was involved in a coordinated raid on 18 locations involving two different counties, involving 26 officers from federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies. Kelly was the tactical dispatcher responsible for tracking the personnel, the status of each team, and resource allocation as needed to secure both those people that were arrested and the children that had to come into protective custody. Task Force commander of the narcotics team was so impressed with her abilities that he said that he would personally request her for future such operations. And one of the things about Kelly that I need to comment on is I mentioned the word tactical. And by that I mean that she has some training over and above the average dispatcher in the fact that we have any major events going on in the city and we set up a command post. Kelly is the person that handles all of the tactical operations, whether it be a SWAT operation, whether it be something of the nature of Colony Days, and she single-handedly handles all the dispatch duties out of that command post. And I'll take it one step further in the fact that she's trained through the U.S. Forest Service, and she's in such high demand that she leaves our department, and we're compensated through the U.S. Forest Service, and she'll leave for several weeks at a time to help out the Forest Service in dispatching their tactical teams on these major wildland fires throughout California. So she's got an incredible amount of training. With all of that going, you know, as a result of her outstanding performance and commitment to duty during this major event I talked about with Narcotics Task Force, Kelly Reblo was bestowed the Chief of Police Certificate of Commendation Award. So, Kelly, congratulations. Let me take a minute and read this to you. In recognition of exceptional tactical dispatching efforts while working with the San Luis Obispo Narcotics Task Force in a multi-county effort requiring in coordination of 226 officers from federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies and the execution of 18 warrants, which occurred on September 6, 2007, she receives the Chief's commendation. In addition, she receives a pin for her uniform. So, again, Kelly.
Congratulations, Kelly. Well deserved. Please continue, Chief.
Thank you, Mayor. Next, I need to have Senior Police Officer Keith Valerios up here. And I have Sergeant Bob Millay. I wish to honor Senior Police Officer Keith Valerios and his police dog, Zepp. Unfortunately, Zepp couldn't make it here tonight. He's feeling under the weather. Zepp was born in Denmark, and he trained in Germany. He became a member for the Atascadero Police Department in 2002, specifically to work with Keith. Both Keith and Zepp have been together ever since, and as partners, in addition to their committed work with the city for Atascadero, they've done numerous calls for service assisting local, county, and state law enforcement agencies with the apprehension of many suspects and the continued recovery of a lot of narcotics. Zepp was recently retired for health reasons and now resides with Keith at their home. Keith continues his patrol assignment as a senior officer with the police department, and both Keith and Zepp enjoy their time off together. With me is Sergeant Bob Millay. He supervises our police canine unit, and he's been spearheading and instrumental in the process of purchasing a new police dog through private donation. So he's here to present our award to Keith.
Good evening, Mayor Brendler, members of council. It's my honor to present this retirement plaque to Senior Police Officer Keith Valerios and his canine, Zepp. The plaque simply says, for an outstanding partner and friend, in recognition of 5 years of dedicated service, both as a police canine and a community ambassador. Keith.
Thank you. Thank you. Zep asked me to pass along to everyone, woof, 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 which others like you will understand. When outsiders see us together, they will envy. Their envy will be measured with their disdain. I will quietly listen to you and pass no judgment, nor will I speak your words. I will remain ever silent, ever vigilant, ever loyal. And when our time together is done and you move on in the world, remember me with kind thoughts and tales. For a time we were unbeatable. Nothing passed among us undetected. If we should ever meet again on another field, I will gladly take up your fight. I am the police working dog, and together we are guardians of the night. Thank you.
Thank you, Officer Valerius. In police work, there's nothing better than to have a dedicated partner, and that certainly includes a canine. And so you take good care of Zep. Thanks to all of our employees in the police department. All right, we will move on to another presentation. We're honored tonight to have our regional representative of the League of California Cities visiting us. Mr. Dave Mullinex is going to speak to issues involving the state budget and the League's opposition to the taking or borrowing of local government's revenues, our redevelopment funds, and transportation funds. And you know, once again, our state government finds itself in a budget gridlock, and in that capacity, they tend to eyeball the piggy banks of local government, and that causes us here on the dais, I'm sure, great frustration and concern. Our city has prepared letters, and I, in the capacity of the mayor, have signed those letters. They've been sent to the governor. And our state, other state leaders, they voice our objections to the taking or borrowing of our local revenues. And we've also prepared a resolution tonight which begs adoption. So, you know, it's time for the state to get its house in order, stop leaning on local government to solve budget problems. And Mr. Mullinex, we certainly welcome your thoughts on this.
Thank you, Your Honorable Mayor and Council members. I hate to follow up those two feel-good presentations with one that would be considered gloomy at best. But once again, what has become a trend since the 90s, every time the state finds itself, their budget in a mess, they come to local governments, whether it's city, county, or special district, and balance their budgets on our backs. And this year, unfortunately, is no different. The state's facing at least a $15 billion deficit. Sacramento has been unwilling or unable to address the real issues at hand and make those tough decisions to balance their budget. When a legislator is sent up there in Sacramento, their first primary job is to craft a balanced budget that works for California. Here at the local level, whether, again, city or county government, you have to make tough decisions, prioritize needs of your community, and make a budget work. And we do that every single year. Now, this year, because of the subprime mortgage meltdown, economic downturn, cities all over the state and through the Tri-County area, our division as well, have had to face these challenges and make tough decisions in order to balance those budgets. We've had revenue shortfalls. Our communities still expect a certain level of service. And you as a council, along with other councils, have had to make those tough decisions and address those in a honest, responsible way. Well, Sacramento, for the first 6 months of this year, claimed that they were not going to borrow our money in order to make their budgets work. Well, I was quoted the other day, as the state's burning, they're up there fiddling. And quite frankly, they did not take their jobs. They have not made those tough decisions. And now they're claiming they want to raid $3 billion of local government money. Now, $3 billion of local government money would represent, to Atascadero, over $1 million more that they would raid from us, and whether they would pay it back or not is really up to some court decisions. And although we did pass an initiative back in 2004 called Proposition 1A, 77% of Californians voted to keep local revenues local and told California, Sacramento, stop reaching into our pockets to balance your budget. In fact, 84% of the county voted for Proposition 1A. Now, in Proposition 1A, it says you cannot raid our local property tax and sales tax monies except in a fiscal emergency. And I think most Californians figured a fiscal emergency would constitute something like an earthquake, a real emergency. Well, here it is, the first year they're able to borrow our money, and they're coming out of the state, communicating that to our legislators. We also need, again, ordinary citizens, leaders in your community to also reach out to your legislators and say, just call them up there in Sacramento and say, hey, don't take our money to balance the budget. And, again, I applaud the efforts of you, your council members, your staff in the past, your community has always been very engaged in the process. And they are up there right now. There's rumors flying around how they're going to fix the budget. It could be a matter of a couple of days. It could be a matter of weeks. It could be months before the budget's fixed. But, again, they need to fix their budget. That's their job to fix their budget, and they don't need to be taking our money here at the local level.
Thank you, Dave. Well, hopefully they will perceive this as a drawing a line in the sand, so to speak. And as I said before, this resolution begs adoption. And some of the other council members would like to weigh in here. And Council Member Clay, I believe you're up.
Hey, Dave, so why are they so far in the hole?
I think a big problem up there has been over the last four or five budget cycles, when there has been a problem that they need to address, they've used accounting gimmickry, smoke and mirrors, push the problem to the next year, the problem gets bigger, they do the same thing the following year, they do the same thing the next year. Now we have a huge problem. And, again, they have refused to show leadership up there.
Do you think that they will add the 1 cent sales tax?
That is, you know what, the latest rumor is that is a distinct possibility. It would probably raise the statewide sales tax, potentially. This is, again, a rumor, that it would raise it a cent, and then over the corresponding years drop after the budget issue was fixed, along with some cuts to programs. You know, back in the 90s, we faced a similar issue. Governor Wilson had a balanced approach of fixing the budget. You know, we had some revenue enhancements. We had some program cuts, and they also raided local revenues back then. It's a different world now, but they can fix the problem. They just need to show some leadership.
Thank you.
Councilmember O'Malley.
Thank you. Well, it does have quite a cumulative effect. As you mentioned, we on the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments met last week and proverbially cut up the credit card for the state, and we looked at it as really over $9 million of projects in our county. So it not only impacts us here, but, for example, improvements to Highway 46, the main avenue for anyone to come and spend money from the valley over in our area, that's in jeopardy. A lot of projects that are even outside of our city would have a major impact on all of us with a tough economic time. But I think it's important to realize, too, there's a multiplier effect of these losses. As you know, we're burning up reserves, $1.5 million close to this year. We're going to hit $2 million next year. We only have enough reserves to get us through about 4 or 5 years maximum, it was estimated. If you add another $1 million a year to that, which this could do, it puts us in an economic crisis within 3 years, and it would be some very tough decisions. So we're very thankful with leadership that we've had in the past that we've set aside some reserves. But those reserves were set aside for particular reasons, to do major projects in the area of roads. And $255,000 of this $1 million was money coming to our area for roads. And as we've all learned, when you don't spend that money on road maintenance, not only are you just losing that $255,000, the cost of repairs in the future escalates geometrically, because we are way behind in road maintenance. And if you don't do them in a timely way, the cost to repair later into the future escalates even more. So it's something very serious for our whole county. I appreciate Mayor Brendler was proactive and got those letters out already, and we need to support this with resolution as every other city has, I believe, in the state.
And you know, again, the point you made, Councilman O'Malley, was the fact that when the state does rate our money here locally, it has direct impacts on our quality of life. We're going to have less paved roads. We're going to have less programs. We're going to have less police and fire on the streets, because when they, you know, it has a direct impact, and there's a direct nexus between when they try to balance their budget on our backs, we suffer. And enough's enough. And like you said, we cut off the credit card last week in a symbolic gesture, trying to send a message to Sacramento that, hey, enough is enough.
And additionally, not only is it the property tax and the road funds, the redevelopment agency as a program is in jeopardy, and that's how we've accomplished most everything we're very proud of in our community, whether it's Sunken Gardens, our community center, Lewis Avenue Bridge, our streetscape downtown. These were redevelopment agency projects through a special mechanism that allowed that funding. This is also under attack by the state right now, so it would be a major impact on our community.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Are there
one proposal does not. And, you know, by the time I get home tonight, it could be completely different.
As you know, the reason why Prop 1A was so heavily supported by not only local governments, by the public in general, was because the state had been rating, this goes back to 1990 or so,
that's right.
ERAF, and so they've taken billions in local funds to balance their budgets. And so we passed Proposition 1A, and in the first version of Proposition 1A was something I can remember collecting signatures with Councilmember O'Malley, and I think that it was something that basically said it this will stop. But then we wanted the cooperation of the governor, and so we acquiesced to his input, and basically there was a compromise, and the compromise is what we have now, where they can borrow the funds. They have to pay them back, but they can borrow them in a fiscal emergency. And as you said, this really isn't it's a fiscal emergency for Sacramento, but it's really not the kind of emergency that we at all thought was the emergency they were talking about in Prop 1A. So we acquiesced to the governor's support in order to get this thing passed more easily. Where is the governor on this?
The governor has, in his initial state of the state earlier in the year, and as may revise, neither of his budgets have called for borrowing of local government revenues. And we have thanked the governor and support that the governor's approach in that. So his approach has not included any borrowing of local government revenues.
Has he said anything about whether he would sign a budget that had that compromise in it, where they would take local funds?
I think right now the way Sacramento is thinking right now, with several dynamics coming into a confluence, and you have the Democrats wanting to get out of town to go to the convention in Denver, and you know some other things, the governor's approval ratings being down at the lowest they've been since he's been in office, if the legislature can come to a deal, he will probably sign it. And right now you've had, again, both parties are very ideological and very polarized. You have very few pragmatic legislators up there. I will say that our Assemblyman Sam Blakeslee has been one of those pragmatic legislators, and he is known to be able to work across the aisle. Abel Maldonado to a lesser extent, but again, once they get up there to Sacramento and they start drinking that Kool-Aid up there, they kind of forget what they're supposed to be doing up there, and they're supposed to be representing us here locally. We send them up to Sacramento to represent our interests here in the district, not to represent the partisan interest or other interests up there in Sacramento, but our interests down here. And that's why we need to communicate in unambiguous, really unambiguous tones, and it's incumbent upon our community, not just our elected officials, but our community, it's incumbent upon them to communicate that to our legislators.
Okay. Thank you, Dave.
Mayor Pro Tem Barrow.
I want to thank you for coming and giving our community the skinny on what's going on. I'm a state employee, so we get all kinds of wild stories of, you know, they're going to cut our pay and all these kind of things. So there's a lot of wild stuff going on up there. Hopefully they'll figure it out soon. But thank you for coming, and I fully support the resolution.
Thank you.
Other comments? Again, Dave, thank you for visiting us and, you know, sharing that information of vital importance here locally. Do we have a motion?
Move
to
approval
adopt?
Of the staff recommendation of this resolution.
I'd second the motion to approve the resolution opposing irresponsible state budget.
All right, we have a motion by Councilmember O'Malley, a second by Councilmember Luna. Procedurally, it's not necessary that I read the entire resolution. Is the heading or the title sufficient?
Yes.
All right. Well, we have the motion. We have the second. And roll call, please.
Councilmember O'Malley?
Yes.
Councilmember Luna?
Yes.
Councilmember Clay?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Bayrou?
Yes.
Mayor Brendler?
Yes.
Resolution passes 5-0.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again, Dave. All right, we will now move on to our consent calendar. There are 13 items on the consent calendar. Is there anyone from council who wishes to pull an item? Is there anyone from the public that would like to pull an item? Seeing none, do we have a motion?
Move approval of the consent calendar.
Second.
We have a motion to approve the consent calendar by council.
This Eagle Scouts and volunteers for contributing to making Stadium Park a jewel in Atascadero. My dog Satchel and I walk the park at least once a week. The trails through the oaks are wonderful. Most people who use our park are respectful and grateful that we have such a serene place in the midst of our town. But I am angry that a few ignorant, unconscious people use our park as a refuse dump. And worse, there is one bench in particular that seems to be the favorite lounge site. As we pass this garbage dump area, the graffiti, beer cans, wine bottles, jack-in-the-box wrappers, cups, napkins, Marlboro boxes, and cigarette lighters, etc., that is left there like a slap in the face. It's an insult. On Sunday, when we were there, the garbagers had left plastic bags, too. So it was convenient for me to pick up after them. You can't even sit on the bench because the cowards have broken their beer bottles on it. It's hard to explain to your grandchildren why some people choose to be such inconsiderate slobs. I realize it's difficult to catch someone in the act of littering because they hide out. But if caught, they should be made to clean up the community for many months and fined heavily. Also, I mentioned taking my dog with me. I usually put plastic bags in my car to clean up after Satchel, but sometimes I forget. I know others who take our dogs want to remain welcome to do so. So could there be a doggy cleanup bag station placed at the entrance to the park? That would be very convenient. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you, Marty. We'll try to get that answered.
Good evening.
Welcome
again.
Steve.
Steve Martin. This time I'm speaking in my capacity as the chairperson for the Atascadero Colony Days Committee. This year, the 35th annual Colony Days celebration will be October the 18th. And we have some surprises coming up as part of that celebration, so we certainly invite everybody to come downtown October the 18th and find out what they are. But one of the things that we have been working on as a board has been to expand our ability to fund the Colony Days activities. In the past, Colony Days has been funded by a combination of grants, sponsorships, button sales. By the way, I have buttons for everybody tonight if you'd like to buy one. A golf tournament that's been put on for the last 20 years by Santa Lucia Bank, and of course we charge vendor fees. And over the years, those revenues have not kept up with expenses, as is the case with so many things in our society nowadays. And this year, the Board of Colony Days Committee decided it would like to give everyone in the community the opportunity to support what is uniquely Atascadero's Founders Day, which is Colony Days. So in partnership with six local banks, we have established something called the Founders Fund. This will be an ongoing fundraising effort that every citizen in Atascadero can contribute to, small contribution, large contribution. Colony Days Committee is a 501c3 organization, nonprofit organization, so people can go to any one of these banks and make contributions as their way of supporting Atascadero Colony Days. And our bank partners are Rabobank, Bank of America, San Lucia Bank, Heritage Oaks Bank, Los Padres Bank, and Washington Mutual. And we thank them very much for the support of this unique local holiday. Once again, a Founders Fund available now at our local participating banks. We invite people to come by and take a look at this poster. The photo on that poster is of a young man who participated in recent years in the Tent City reenactment as part of Colony Days. Shelly Von Stein took this picture, and she's very generously allowed us to use it as part of the publicity this year. So Colony Days, October the 18th. And Colony Days buttons, $1 apiece. See me after the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Welcome, Joan.
Excuse me, Mayor Brendler, council people. I'm Joan O'Keefe, Atascadero. And for 2 years, I've been before you telling you that there's been no progress toward restoring the printry. The denial and foot-dragging by the city has been mind-boggling for me. I've since found out the situation is much worse than I could have ever imagined. In a nutshell, the printry has been stripped of its assets. The Masons were able to pawn off to the consul a building that had so much deferred maintenance that it was unsafe before the earthquake. The Masons got a new building, the city received $4 million in FEMA funds, and Mr. Gerhardt got the printry, with an estimated cost of $7 million to restore it in 2004. Recently, Kelly offered the Historical Society a room for their museum in the restored printry, and they believed him. The Chamber picked him as their Citizen of the Year, and the Colony Day Committee chose him as last year's Grand Marshal for the Colony Day Parade. In March 2006, the printry was transferred to Kelly Gerhardt. The very same day it was transferred, he took out a $1 million loan with Heritage Oaks. Upon the building being secured, that is mothballed. The city's still dreaming. So the printry, one of the two registered historical buildings in Atascadero, has been stripped of its assets, has outstanding loans of $4.8 million, is delinquent on its property taxes, and has deed restrictions that say the building shall be preserved for 20 years. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome, Dave.
Good evening, council members. My name is David Broadwater. Those last comments sure sound like that situation needs some serious investigation, by the way. A couple things I wanted to mention is I wanted to commend probably the city clerk for the change in the way the agenda reads under consent calendar. There's been some confusion at a couple of recent meetings about what kind of comments were appropriate during the consent calendar when draft minutes came up of previous meetings. And it's now been added that the comments during consent calendar on draft minutes, if you're just talking about the accuracy of those minutes, that's appropriate. But if you want to comment, if anyone desires to express their opinion concerning issues included in the draft minutes, they should share their opinion during the community forum portion of the meeting. And I think that's an improvement. It'll probably avoid some kind of confusion in the future. So I commend the clerk and I assume who got that done. The other thing is, the comments on the stadium park. I like to hike there, too. I like to go up to the top of the mountain and have the 360-degree view of the town or take some of the lower trails through the Oaks. But when you walk into the stadium park and get into the introduction as you're going in there up the trail, this time at the second bench, which is very near the entrance, the one that has a placard on it from a member of the Land Preservation Society, Deborah Stafford, you can't even sit down on that bench without lacerating your butt with a broken glass and trash strewn across the trail and down the hillside.
Anybody coming into this town walks into Stadium Park to look at something that's a kind of a natural jewel in this town is going to have maybe thoughts about what this town thinks of itself when it allows it to be trashed like that. Now, I know it's an enforcement problem or, you know, maybe a money problem with getting people out there to look at it, but it just looks like a trash dump when you first walk into it. At times, and it's embarrassing, and I sure hope something can be done about it. Thanks.
Thank you. Welcome, Maria.
Hi, Maria Hooper. I'm living in Atascadero, and I too up here. Sorry about the printery. last October, I joined some other people, and we came in front of the city council requesting that you step in and take some action in the restoration process of the printery. My understanding is that the city is bound by the deed restrictions, even though the city's not currently the owner. The number one concern was that winter was coming, and the broken windows were going to allow the elements to do even more damage to the inside of the building. I know the city tried, but it took until May to motivate the current owner to do something to protect the interior, which was a moot point by then because we'd already had our storms and more damage had been done. Once again, the printery's been vandalized. There are more broken windows. We don't really know what else has happened on the inside. I know the Historic Society has approached the city staff and requested that the building be mothballed, which is a procedure that is somewhat costly, but will put the building into a coma until someone who actually cares about the restoration can come along and revive it. I also know that the current financial state of the printery is that there's $35,000 due in back property tax, and that the current owner has borrowed over $4 million against it, with more than one lender being involved. I have a few questions then. Is the city considering mothballing the printery? If so, is the city considering paying for the mothballing since the current owner is really slow to react to things like that to protect the building? Should the building go up for auction at some point, how would the city maintain the deed restrictions if somebody else steps into the picture? And finally, do you see the city potentially buying it, should it go up for auction, buying it back? Those are my questions.
Thank you.
Good evening, council and staff. Jim Shannon, Coromar Avenue, Atascadero. Two items I'd like to touch on tonight. The first is, I know a couple months ago, a couple people got up here and spoke about what's going on at Curburel with the off-ramp and the traffic there. I live at the corner of Curburel and Coromar, and over the last couple years with all the traffic, and now it's even been enhanced with the construction going on here at 41, I've lost two trees completely where people have came and turned around on my driveway and knocked them down, uprooted them, and killed them. I have one that was hit 2 weeks ago that's still leaning. It will probably die. I'll probably have to cut it down. I know that our city engineer said that stop signs would be installed by this summer, and it still hasn't happened. It's just a constant barrage of cars turning around on my driveway. There's almost accidents every afternoon and evening of people coming down in the dip there, making U-turns and almost getting T-boned and stuff like that. The edge of my driveway, the edge of the roadway has been compromised from people constantly coming and turning around. I want to know what's going to be done about that. We've told us it's going to be fixed, and nothing's been done. The second thing I want to touch on is it was announced a week or two ago that Mr. Brendler and Mr. Luna are not running, and I want to thank Mr. Luna for his time he's put in. I think he served honorably until about 2006, July of 2006, when I think he took a turn to the wrong side, in my opinion. I think he knows what I'm talking about. And then I have some concerns with Mr. Brendler and what his duties are going to be after he leaves his council, especially after I heard him on the Dave Conklin show last Wednesday when Bob Kelly was on there. And I'd like to ask you what you meant when you said that Wade McKinney needs to be looking for a new job or something to that effect. And I would hope that from what I've read on a couple blog pages and people that have written on your behalf and things that you've said that I've kind of read between the lines on, I'm hoping that you're not going to I'm asking you on this date, the 12th of August, 2008, that you're not going to continue the hatred and the bitterness and all the division that's going on in the city when you get off of this council. And I don't know if you got to get even with your attitude or whatever is going to happen, but I don't like what I heard. I don't like what I've read, that certain people better watch out for what you're going to do to them when you're off this council. I have concerns for that. We have enough bitterness and divide going on in this community. You talk about wanting to move forward and do things, but I don't think your intentions are honorable when you leave here, and I wish you'd be open and transparent, as you say, and be honest with the people what your true intentions are going to be if you're going to continue the division and the hatred that's going on here. Thank you.
I'll address that at the end. So, welcome, Lee.
Thank you. Lee Perkins from Atascadero. And it's my understanding that when someone's up here, they're not supposed to direct one city council member. So that's a question I have for later. And then I have a couple other questions and requests. I wonder if when the next strategic planning meeting is scheduled for, or if it's been replaced by other kinds of meetings. I agree with Joan about the plenary, and I would ask tonight that the city council direct staff to agendize this for to answer all the questions that have been asked tonight. What needs to happen is to have it agendized. And it's refreshing in a way to agree with Jim, who's just up here. As of 3 days ago, the stop sign that was promised in the spring for the summer is still not there. And then I have an article I'd like to read about Walmart.
Excuse me, Lee.
Yes.
Just for clarification, you refer to the stop sign. Are you referring to the same location, Kerberil?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Please continue.
And the article is Walmart Faces Minnesota Labor Law Trial. And this is from the Bloomington News, July 2nd, 08, Southfield, Michigan. Walmart Stores, Inc. broke Minnesota labor law, a state judge ruled, handing the world's largest retailer its third straight defeat in a wage class action trial, and the possibility a jury may order it to pay $2 billion. The company required hourly employees to work off the clock during training and denied full rest or meal breaks in violation of state laws. Minnesota District Judge Robert King Jr. ruled yesterday. He said Walmart broke labor laws more than 2 million times and ordered the company to give employees $6.5 million in back pay. Walmart's failure to compensate plaintiffs was willful, the judge wrote. Walmart was on notice from numerous sources of the wage and hour violations at issue and failed to correct the problem. The lawsuit is one of more than 70 cases, including case actions or group suits, in which Walmart has been accused of wage violations. The retailer lost a $78 million jury verdict in Pennsylvania in 06 over rest breaks and unpaid work, and a $172 million verdict in California in 05 over meal breaks. Both verdicts have been appealed. King's decision means Walmart will face a second trial in Minnesota State Court, this time before a jury. The lawsuit was filed by four women on behalf of 56,000 Walmart and Sam's Club employees. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome, Joanne.
Joanne Main, Atascadero Chamber, and I'd like to piggyback on some of the comments, but particularly on Stadium Park and other parks. And I know that the city staff is working as hard as they can, given the revenue that they have to maintain our parks. And perhaps the community has to step forward and be more friendly to business, more open to business and development, because that's what's going to pay the way to maintain our parks and our zoo and to keep our quality of life going, is we need to have revenue-generating businesses in town. With a diminishing budget, you know, we can complain all we want, but those poor guys are out there day in and day out trying to keep up with the hours and the revenue they have to do it with. On a positive note, the Chamber will be hosting an Empower Hour on the 19th. It's a Tuesday, next Tuesday at 7:30 a.m. at the Carlton Ambrosia Room. And the topic will be the Santa Margarita Ranch. We felt it was important to know as much as we can about that project, since it's really so close to our community. And Doug Filipponi and Jamie Kirk will be the speakers for that. And everyone is welcome. It's just a quick morning, 7:30 to 8:30. The cost is just $10 at the door. And then to celebrate the Chamber moving into their new location, we are hosting an open house on Thursday, August 21st from 5:30 to 7:30. We'd love the community to stop in and see what we've done and how we've stepped up to the plate to help service the business community. And then finally, the community barbecues, Tuesday in the park barbecues. We have two more after tonight. And next week is going to be a very large one, and it's for the group ECHO, the El Camino Homeless Association. And then the final one is the Kiwanis Club. And I sure hope that the community comes out and supports these last two barbecues and enjoys what the Elks provide every Tuesday. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor and City Council members. I want to be positive tonight, and like the man spoke before, I do want to thank Mr. George Luna.
Your name, sir, for the record?
Tino Santos. I think everybody knows me, but I'm supposed to say it. Mr. Luna, I think, has served this city quite well, and one thing I admire him, even though I don't agree with him, as I said, the last 2 years, too. He's a very diplomatic man and does things in a very mild and beautiful manner, and for that I want to thank him for the years of service he has given to Atascadero. I also, since I'm on a positive note, I want to thank our neighbors to the north, Paso Robles, that their state fair or mid-state fair was such a success. And I just read in a paper they're also going to get a new store. Bed, Bath, and Beyond is coming to Paso Robles. So I think we probably should consult with them and find out what they do that attracts business while we lose it. And I want to thank God for Walmart. Got this free shirt from them. They provide many jobs. They provide many opportunities. And those who don't like Walmart, they have the right not to shop there, but don't deprive the rest of us who want to shop there, work there. So I just thank God that we still live in a free country, that if you don't want to frequent a store, you don't have to. But if you want to, nobody should impede you or spread lies and promote things that are not true against a business that has a right to exist. And being on a positive note, I want to say there's a future for Atascadero, and I know many of you are working very hard to make this a better town, and with God's help, it will be. But we need cooperation, and we don't need socialism or environment nuts who would deprive us of opportunities to live in a free country, a country that I came many years ago, a country that I love, a country that offers opportunities. And socialism and communism and environment wackos are destroying this country, but not quite. I think God will have the final word, and good men and good women of goodwill. Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'm Nora Trenacosta, Atascadero resident. And golly, following the insights of Mr. Molyneux, I feel more strongly than ever how much we need to protect our local revenue here in Atascadero. And because of that, I wanted to take a few moments to bring everyone's attention to Measure DO8, the Save the Atascadero Shield measure, coming to the ballot box near you in November. A group of concerned citizens put Measure DO8 on the ballot with the support of thousands of their friends and neighbors. And we did this because we wanted to make sure that Atascadero's climate supports revenue-generating business that promotes the long-term interest and sustainability of our community. Measure DO8 protects revenue, choice, and jobs. These are three critical components for our continued prosperity as a community. Other communities nationwide have suffered grave losses at the hands of unbridled superstore development. All the major cities in our area have similar ordinance on the books, and it has not prevented appropriate development in Paso. Answering Mr. Santos' question about attracting business in Paso Robles, this may be one of the regulations that succeeds in doing that in Paso Robles. Paso Robles, Arroyo Grande, Santa Maria, and San Luis Obispo all have similar ordinances. Make no mistake, if we do not give our downtown development a head start, as has been done in other cities such as Paso and Arroyo Grande, we will never get a second chance at creating a vibrant city center. Let's learn what other communities already know and save Atascadero. I only have a few moments here, so I'm going to touch on just a few reasons why Measure DO8 protects and enhances revenue source for our city. Superstores drain city revenue. The pattern is clear nationwide. Cities report an average of 46 to 48 cent loss for every dollar generated by big box superstores. This comes in the form of increased traffic and infrastructure demand, as well as increased law enforcement needs, especially at 24-hour locations. Sales generated by superstores do not constitute increased revenues. 84% of these sales comes from displaced local merchants. Only 16% of sales at superstore revenues come from outside the host community. Property values in areas surrounding superstores decline an average of 25%. Tax assessors routinely cite superstores in their devaluations. Lower property values hurt homeowners and decrease property tax revenues. These are just a few of the dozens of ways that unstructured development puts our community, as well as our community chest, at risk. I don't have time here to give you the benefit of the dozens of studies showing these findings, but know that they are from city and county governments, major universities and research institutions, the U.S. House of Representatives, the National Trust for Historic Preservation. Don't take my word for it. Check out these valuable resources. You'll find them listed in the next few weeks on our major DO8 website with links to these home organizations and original research. Check out www.saveatascadero.com. Remember to vote yes for Atascadero's downtown and vote yes for major DO8. Thank you.
Thank you, Nora. Welcome.
Good evening. My name is Tom McGee. Atascadero resident, longtime resident. On a positive note, I'd like to thank the Atascadero Police Department for their continued drive-bys of my business. I see them early in the morning, late at night, and it just feels good to have that kind of protection. My only complaint so far today is that the bus stop located in front of my business has no trash can. So every morning I have to pick up the trash from the bus stop. Also, the bus stop across the street from my business doesn't have enough room to pull the bus off the edge of the road. So people are dropped into some nice lady's ice plant. So I would like the city to perhaps approach Wilmar Disposal, Atascadero Waste Alternatives. Since they do such a bang-up job, maybe they could donate a few trash cans to the bus stops that don't have them.
Thank you. Is there anyone else from the public that would like to speak? Yes, sir. Please come forward. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. Hi, my name is Chris Koval. I live on Hermosa Avenue here in Atascadero. The San Jacinto repaving project, I feel, has not been kind of like handled right. That was not really a bad road. Now, I've got like Lake Atascadero 2 in front of my home. My neighbor across the street where the runoff goes. He acquired a slide from Parks and Recreation, which is steel, so kids can't slide down it when it's 110 degrees in the summertime. But just to avoid erosion and flooding his garage, he's implanted that, and on the roadside he's put bricks in, so, you know, it's taking care of his property. On top of that, no notices were really given as far as what days Union Asphalt would be out there, as far as what days, you know, the road would be accessible or not, to whereas you'd have to drive, I don't know, half a mile, or I'll say 5/10 of a mile, okay, that's half, to actually access the road, only to be turned around with road closed signs. There was never any dates given as far as what days the actual work of it would be, you know, happening and what days weren't. It's been, you know, kind of like ping-ponging around in my neighborhood. Now, Cayuga Street, on the other side of Hermosilla, right by the stop sign, that road has got like a kind of a percolation thing, natural spring thing going on. Now, there's been potholes, and I mean, almost have enough, big enough to swallow a VW, okay? And it's like, forgive me, but teenager's pimply face. I mean, the thing is just, and it can't be more than maybe at maximum 600 feet long. This street has problems. As a matter of fact, I talked to the kid that was holding up, and they're going, hey, you shouldn't be on this road. It said road closed. Well, I didn't know it was closed today. You know, it's just, you know, shot in the dark when you come around the corner and the signs are up, and maybe the signs weren't. I says, well, you know what? If you guys got a little time here, and I know this isn't by your contract, could you guys put some asphalt on a flatbed truck or in a loader or something and just kind of run it around the corner up here and fill something up over here? Funny enough,
excuse me, Mr. Cobalt.
A couple of these holes did, but anyway, that's the good side of it. But in the meantime, a road that really,
Mr. Cobalt, your time has expired. I'm sorry,
okay.
but I would like to ask, just for clarification, the drainage issue you referred to, was at San Jacinto and Hermosilla?
No, it's on Hermosilla, about midway through the block. Between that and Cayuga Street.
We'll try to get an answer, that question answered.
Yeah, somebody could take a look at that one. That'd be very nice. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anyone else from the public wishing to comment? Seeing none, we'll return to the council and try to have some of these questions answered. Marty Brown raised concerns about littering, graffiti, alcohol violations at Stadium Park. That concern was also brought forward by Mr. Broadwater, and I believe there was also a request that perhaps the city install a dog station. And Mr. McKinney, are you in a position to answer any of these questions?
I can follow up with Public Works and see what experience we've had there and what our schedule is, see about the dog station.
And what about enforcement activity? It's rather difficult, I think, for the police officers to adequately patrol that because it's...
there's no access.
Right. Is there anything that you think we might be able to come up with that may allow us to keeping a little bit extra eye on that location?
It's going to be a difficult location. We can look at what our options are, but it is going to be a difficult location.
Understood. Thank you. All right. Joan O'Keefe raised additional questions about the printery, and I certainly concur with the fact that this whole printery issue is, I think, determined a fiasco. It's probably appropriate. We did have some discussions in about the printery in closed session, but I don't believe that we're in a position to discuss those. Is that, Mr. Pirick?
That's correct.
All right. But I can indicate that the city is taking steps to try and resolve some of the questions that you have raised, Joan.
Mike, wouldn't you say the city is looking at all their options in regards to the printery?
I would term that an appropriate comment, yes. Mr. Broadwater also commended Marcia Torgerson for the agenda language that's been added, referenced the consent calendar, and I too think that was a step in the right direction. Maria Hooper also raised issues about the printery, and she asked four specific questions. Now, I don't know, are we in a position to address those tonight? They're rather brief. One dealt with, is the city considering mothballing the printery? The other question was, will the city be absorbing the expense for that activity? And I think she also asked about if the property transfers, will the city potentially buy it back?
We have directed the property owner to mothball the building, and we are, as you've indicated, looking at a variety of alternatives to ensure mothballing or improvement of the building.
Question to Wade. If the present owner sells it, why all the conditions transfer with the sale? Is that not right?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Right. Mr. Shannon and Lee Perkins, I believe, both brought up the issue of stop signs. And I do know that this issue has been raised before at Kerberil, and I believe it was the northbound.
We have completed the design and plans and have submitted to Caltrans. They have not yet approved the plans and, in fact, requested additional information from us a week or so ago. And so we are urging Caltrans to move as rapidly as possible to give us the permit to allow those stop signs.
And it's fair to say Caltrans does have certain procedures that sometimes take a little extra effort to get things done?
Yes.
All right.
Mayor Brindler, if I just yes. would like to ask Mr. McKinney if you could email me on that and let me follow up as our city's representative on the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments Board. We sit with the regional director of Caltrans, and I'll ask Supervisor Patterson to join me, and we'll just make sure folks know we want to keep that moving along. There are a couple of issues that Caltrans could maybe use a reminder on.
All right, thank you. Let's see, Joanne Main commented the city needed to be business friendly. I'm not so certain I fully understand that. This council, I think, has made efforts to approve many, many commercial projects. The only one that I think there's been some contentiousness with deals with the project on the north side of town, and I anticipate that will remain contentious until November when some decisions are made by the electorate. Mr. Santos, Mr. McGee requested a trash can at the bus stop. And is that something that perhaps can be accomplished?
Well, I'll certainly follow up on that and see what we have there and where the route is.
Okay. Maybe Mr. McGee can contact you or somebody on staff and really lay out specifically what his concerns are.
Yes.
Mr. Cobalt raised this issue of a drainage issue on Hermosilla. And is that something that...
We can certainly follow up and look into it. Neither one of those streets are city-maintained.
They are not?
They are non-city-maintained roads.
All right. Well, perhaps, Mr. Cobalt, if you're still in the audience, perhaps you can put your complaint or concerns in writing and submit those to the city, and then the city can respond to the specifics of your concerns. And that, I think, takes care of most of the questions. Mr. Shannon raised some issues about comments that I made recently on Congleton addressing my question or addressing some questions to candidate Bob Kelly. And the comments that Mr. Shannon attributed to me are not accurate. They were comments that were made by Mr. Kelly. I don't know if you want to. If you want to find out, ask Mr. Kelly what that was. And as far as, you know, between reading the lines, you know, I may be stepping down from council duties. I believe that I'm going to be far more effective on the other side of the dais as far as advocating for good government, and I intend to do exactly that. And though we may not share the same opinions and philosophies on certain things, I will find it very... I will find it much easier to advocate my positions from the lectern, and that's about all I have to say to you on that. So with that done, then I think we can close the community forum and prepare to move on to our public hearings. Is there anyone from council that would like to take a break? Are we ready to continue? You would like a quick break? 5 minutes? Will that work? Okay, we will take a five-minute break, and we will resume with our first public hearing, which will be deal with vegetative growth and refuse abatement. Oh, I'm sorry. This is a public hearing. It's... And we are beginning with a public hearing, item B1, that deals with vegetative growth and refuse abatement, and that will be presented by Fire Chief Kurt Stone.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor and Council. Thank you. We'll make this brief. As you know, earlier public hearings declared refuse and weeds a public nuisance. Inspections were conducted and notices were sent out to approximately 4,500 homes. And this year we wound up abating or cutting with the city's contractor 150 lots. Those 150 lots were not in compliance with the weed abatement ordinance. This year we saw a significant increase in the number of lots we abated. Last year, as a point of example, we abated 84 lots. We attribute this to early and copious amounts of rain, a warm spring. And what was really interesting this year is with the early fire season that happened, we had a very heightened sense of awareness in the community, and we had lots of reports that we could not normally visualize or see from the street, and we had reports of people, neighbors with property in their back or that you could not easily see from the street that normally we would have potentially missed were then being brought to our attention by neighbors or neighborhoods who wanted a more fire-safe neighborhood. So that actually worked to our advantage in producing a good product this year, I think, which is a very complete weed abatement program. Additionally, the increase in technology and our ability to map and evaluate properties from the GIS mapping with our partners in technology certainly aided us this year. So this resolution is asking that council adopt this and place the cost of abatement on the tax roll. And with that, I'll conclude the staff report.
Thank you, Chief. Are there questions from council? Seeing none, we'll open this to the public. Would the public, anyone from the public like to comment on this matter? Seeing none, we'll return it to the council. And are there comments by council? I'd just like to say one, from everything I've determined, it appears the city does bend over backwards, so to speak, to seek cooperation from people in trying to avoid forced abatement, so to speak. So, we just need to continue down that road and hope that our citizenry recognizes the importance of cutting those weeds down. We see all around us the repercussions from the fires. Luckily, knock on wood, we haven't had to go through that here in Atascadero. But that said, do we have a motion?
Mr. Mayor,
that there does ask for disclosure of any ex parte communications. I don't have any, but I don't know if we need to know that.
Why don't we start with Jerry? Jerry?
No.
Tom? None?
None.
None.
And then I will seek...
Mr. Mayor, I move that we, the council, adopt the draft resolution confirming the cost of vegetative growth and the refuse abatement.
We have the motion by Councilmember Luna. Who's second? Second by Councilmember O'Malley. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Clay?
Yes.
Councilmember Luna?
Yes.
Councilmember O'Malley?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Bayrou?
Yes.
Mayor Brendler?
Yes.
Motion passes 5-0.
And thank you. All right, we will now move to our first management report, which is campaign finance ordinances and related issues. And actually, let me clarify that when I say report, that there will be a supplemental report, as I understand, by Mr. Pyrick. And then we will move into public comment, and I have a few words to say before we do that. So, Mr. Pyrick?
Yes, thank you, Mayor Brendler. On July 8th, I presented the report to you regarding campaign finance ordinances and related issues, and a copy of that report is also in your agenda packet this evening. I've also provided you with a supplemental staff report, which amplifies slightly on the matter of the posting of the Form 460s on the Internet. And I also provided you with copies of some government code sections which pertain to that matter, namely government code section 6254.21 and 6254.24. And basically what those code sections provide is that there's several professions and occupations of persons. If they fall into that category, then their addresses cannot be posted by the city on the Internet without their permission. There's approximately 20 categories, district attorneys, judges, and the like. And I believe city clerk has something that she can add as well on this subject, so I would ask her to comment as well.
Thank you. I just wanted to add that as I had emailed the council, but I wanted to make sure everyone was aware of the fact that our city, myself in particular, has been looking into the issue of 460s on the web for a few elections, probably since 2004. And there has been conflicting information out there from the state and different agencies that made me uncomfortable posting them until I felt confident that we were doing it the right way. And so I have, since 2004, always created a binder of all the 460s that candidates were filing during the election season to have up at our front counter to make it easier for the public to come in. All those documents are public record. Anyone can come in and see them. But I actually put it in a binder, made it more convenient for the public, but also more convenient for us to not have to pull it out in and out all the time from folders. So, and in doing that, we were always thinking that it would be great if we could put on the website also. So it hasn't really been until this election season that I have talked to other city clerks and more conversations with the FPPC, and I feel comfortable with the redaction issue. I have just decided that if we redact all addresses and phone numbers, all personal information, then we're covered. We don't have to worry about whether we're redacting certain ones and not others. And so I have put the 460s for the candidates in this election on our website.
Just a brief question.
Sure.
I don't recall phone numbers being part of the 460s. Am I in error there?
There are some places on there where they ask for either a fax number or maybe it's not the 460 actually. Maybe it's a 410 or something. That could be. I'm thinking of all the FPPC forms.
I don't ever recall phone numbers being required on the 460.
Okay, then it's just the address. Any person the Public Records Act specifically states, addresses or phone numbers or any personal information.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Councilmember O'Malley, you had a question?
Yes, for the city clerk. And again, this is something Ellen Barrow and I had discussed as part of our Public Trust Committee, and I think it's good you went ahead with that on the Form 460s. I think you are planning on going ahead with all public documents, such as Forms 460s show all income and expenditures related to campaigns, at least that are reported by anyone that's registered as a campaign committee or a candidate. And would you also at some point post Form 700s, we all do, which shows all assets we own in a jurisdiction? And also there's another form required by FPPC where we show all of our fundraising activities in the community. And I think it makes perfect sense to have all of those FPPC required forms available. Is that something you're looking at?
Actually, I have not looked at the 700s or any of the other documents. I mean, because the 460 had always been the one that people were interested in during campaign seasons. I mean, that's the one that people would come in and look at.
Sure.
So, yes, the 700s are looked at occasionally, probably a lot less. And maybe the city attorney would have know what the law is about the 700s and posting them on the web. I'm not familiar with the
Well, what's
law.
Good is I think most folks don't realize how many reporting requirements there are, and I think the more that they're available, I think does help folks realize the accountability.
Yeah, and I want to stress, for the public here too, is that whenever we talk about these things, I always worry that when they say, well, it's not available, it's not easy enough for us to get to, it should be on the web, it implies that it's not a public record or that we're not making it available to the public. I want to make sure that people realize that all these documents are public records. They've always been available
right to
them here at City Hall. You're welcome to come in anytime and take a look at them. But this, adding them to the website, especially those items where a lot of people come in to look at them, it makes sense to do so. If it's an item that no one hardly ever asks for,
right,
we spend the time scanning and redacting and putting on the web, the cost probably isn't appropriate for the small amount of people that are actually interested in it. So you have to weigh that out.
A small number ask, but I think, aren't you the first city clerk in the county to do this? I think we're the only city that's actually posting them on the web. Is that a good accomplishment on your part?
I'm not positive. I know people have said that. I have actually, other clerks have been talking about doing it. I haven't talked to them recently. I've been kind of busy with the election and everything, so I haven't actually talked to them. So it's very probable that I am, yes.
Councilmember Luna?
First of all, I want to commend you for finally posting these 460s on the web. And the city attorney has come up with a supplemental a report that basically talked about specific laws dealing with the revealing the addresses of judges and policemen and whatever. And that's really not an issue here because we're redacting all of them, right?
Right. That's why I just decided we'll just not worry about who it is and just redact everybody's personal information.
And that makes it relatively simple because we're not talking about a lot of pages. I think 10 or 14 pages of redactions you can probably do in 5 minutes.
Right, and of course it depends on, in this case we're doing candidates, so however many candidates. Right now we have five people who have filed with, I think, two or three committees, so, and it depends on what status they are as to whether they have to file 460, so not all of them are even filing 460s necessarily. So yes, it's a small amount.
I do want to mention that I think it's a mistake to necessarily consult with the FPPC or the state, because they are back in the Stone Age. The federal government has been doing this. The FEC has been doing this for at least 8 years. You can go online, put in your zip code, and they'll give you all the contributions to all of the candidates, presidential, Republicans, Democrats, whatever, from this particular zip code. And it lists the occupation as well as the name, and, of course, who the contribution is going to. It doesn't list the addresses, so clearly this is legitimate and isn't revealing anything that isn't a public information. The second thing is that Councilmember O'Malley mentioned other forms, and I do think that those are really appropriate to post, because I was criticized because I voted on an issue for which my wife was alleged, she was not at the time, to be a member of a nonprofit. And I know that Councilmember O'Malley has been criticized for voting on budget issues or whatever that involved nonprofits for which he was a board member. And I think that those kinds of things probably should be somehow revealed before those votes are taken, sort of a ex parte revelation. I think that's part of openness and transparency. And if these things, these records were on the web, then I think there would be probably more questions, more openness, people more interested in these things than they otherwise would be.
Of course, the problem is you know, there isn't a form that lists all of our activities in membership organizations. I usually do mention that, but I usually have, whenever I'm in a campaign, have a website that lists, you know.
Excuse me, rather than debate this at this point,
well, I think
this
I'm just making
this
an
is a time really for time for questions, and then we can get to that other aspect of it. Marcia, I had a question.
Can I just make one comment, if you don't
yes.
mind, to what Councilmember Luna was saying? Just so that you know, the 700, you know, I have had it in the back of my mind that I was going to look into that. I can say, so I've thought about it. I know I went to some websites of other cities who already have 460s up, and they didn't have 700s up. I did notice that. But I haven't gone really any farther than that. So I will look into it and let you know what I come up with.
Well, maybe we can be on the cutting edge in that regard. I'm curious about, there was an indication that there were, perhaps there was some significant labor involving in this issue of posting the 460 on the website, and I wanted to get your take on that, because from my understanding, we're talking about burning a copy of the candidate's 460, using a felt pen or something similar to that to simply strike out the address and phone number if that was required. I don't remember. But and then the process of scanning the document for entry onto the website. Now, is that, from your perspective, is that considered significant labor?
I think the confusion about that to some people was that we were talking at the time about doing all council members, and there were people that wanted previous elections posted so that we have a whole history of everybody who's on the council, which would be very substantial amount of documents for previous elections, including current ones. And when you think about copying and then redacting, yes, it's all just a task that you have to do one at a time in between other things, and then the scanning, and then you have to create the document, and then putting it on the website. Actually, we had problems just in doing the few that are on there right now. It took us like a day and a half or something because we had some problems with linking the documents and whatever. So, I mean, things like that come up. It wasn't real easy, but maybe it's because it was our first time of trying to do it, too, so I'm hoping it'll be easier next time.
Well, were you under the understanding that that this was going to require us to go to past elections and post this information, or that we were going to start in essence from this current election?
Well, no, I didn't know that any decision had been made, but I just, in the conversations that have been happening over the months, I know there were people who were saying that they thought that for all of you, they would wanted your history of 460s, at, you know, before, current, and in the future.
What was that? Perhaps somebody that was on the committee could answer that. Was that something that was proposed?
No, I just mean,
because I don't remember that being proposed.
I just mean in discussions over the months with public, and I'm not saying that there was any council direction or anything to that.
Okay.
No.
All right. Are there other questions?
Well, I did want to clarify, as I brought up about Form 700s, and then in response, George mentioned some items. Form 700s only list personal assets of council members. It does not reference any activities we are involved with, such as nonprofit organizations, correct?
The Form 700?
Yes.
Correct.
And one way to get at participation in what Councilmember Luna suggested, which I had said, is also posting the newly required form last year or two of any fundraising activities council members are involved in community organizations. That would address Councilmember Luna's thought, and you know, I think that's a good idea too. I think we could even go beyond that. I personally, I think it's a good idea to have listed all of our activities, much like in our minutes. And I'm just wondering if that could be possible. So I'll make sure it's in the form of a question. That, you know, currently in our agendas, we list the assignments we have as council members, you know, chair of EVC board or something. But we could easily have a section on the web where any memberships we have, you could list for council members. And that's a resource. And I think that's what you were suggesting. And I think that's a good idea as well. For example, Kiwanis or Itasca Native Tree Association or Historical Society. So that's something I think we could consider on our committee, for example.
And refresh my memory, Marcia, the 700 is a statement of economic
interests.
Yes. Thank you. Councilmember Clay.
I think we're getting into overkill here. You can put my 460, you can put anything you want, but getting into organizations that you belong to, good heavens, I mean, we're getting into overkill.
Well, you're proud to be a part of Kiwanis, though, right?
Are there other questions by council? Seeing none, then what we will do is we will... And Mr. Pyrick, were you concluded?
Yes, I was.
All right. Then we will, as we said we would now allow people from the public to weigh in. And I would ask to those of you that spoke last time, I think there was eight of you, if your comments of support or non-support are generically the same, perhaps you can defer to people who have not yet spoken. And of course, if you want to speak to the issues addressed by Mr. or in any way addressed by Mr. Pyrick in the supplemental staff report, you're certainly welcome to the lectern.
Question. So, I have a question. I mean, is that all we get? I mean, you've got quite a bit here, Brian. We need a staff report on this so the public can.
Mr. Pyrick provided that staff report, as I recall, at the last council meeting.
Yes, at the council meeting on July 8th, I went through the staff report in quite some detail. My comments this evening were limited to the supplemental staff report. I can respond to questions if you like.
I'm not sure what we're even looking at tonight. Maybe you could do a review of what you're proposing to us.
Well, what I was asked to do was to provide a report regarding the issues of campaign finance ordinances and related issues. Those are outlined in the report that was done on July 8th and that I presented that evening. With respect to campaign finance ordinances, I did the legal analysis. With respect to ordinances that some cities have with regard to limits on contributions, I pointed out that you could not have mandatory expenditure limits. I also provided in that report a chart on campaign finance ordinances in California, some 400-plus cities, and reported that of the 400-plus cities, 100 of them had campaign contribution ordinances and the balance did not. I further did an analysis of the cities in San Luis Obispo County that did have campaign finance ordinances. The only one is the city of San Luis Obispo. And I pointed out, I believe there's one city in Monterey County that had has such ordinance. I mentioned the various types of campaign finance ordinances, which I found based on my review of the various types that were available in the state by different cities. There were some six different categories of those. I, in addition, pointed out that there are a number of cities, when they consider the campaign finance ordinances, would include codes of ethics as part of that consideration. In addition, there are many cities that do not have campaign finance ordinances but have instead opted for a code of ethics as a method of providing transparency in government and some of the other goals of such codes. And many cities have such codes of ethics, and I provided examples of those as attachments to the report of July 8th. In fact, there were some 17 attachments to that report, and attachments 7 through 13 were samples of codes of ethics from a number of cities, including several in San Luis Obispo County. I included Morro Bay, Pismo Beach, Paso Robles, San Luis Obispo, and I added two from Santa Barbara County, namely the city of Santa Maria and the city of Goleta. I also included the code of ethics from Santa Clarita, city of Santa Clarita, which is one of the cities that my law firm represents, and we drafted that code of ethics so to provide a diversity of examples of codes of ethics of a number of cities. In addition to that, the report addressed the subject of voluntary candidate declarations, and I provided, it was attachment 14, was the FBPC sample of a declaration. There are a number of cities that have such declarations. That's another option that's available to the council if that is something that you wanted to consider in terms of declaring with respect to campaign practices. I discussed the issue of disclosure of campaign contributions, Form 460s, and I provided a supplemental report this evening with some further information on that. The other subjects were the disclosure of campaign contributions during council meetings and the issue of late contribution reports. And finally, with regard to the fiscal impact, with regard to any action that the council might take on this subject, that would depend upon what direction you would give so that we would then review it and get back to you with regard to what the cost of that would be to the city. So that's kind of an overview of what we talked about on July 8th, in case there was anyone who is here this evening that didn't have an opportunity to hear that report. The report itself, as I said, is in the agenda packet and it's available on the website as well. And I also provided a copy of a couple of league papers as well as attachments, which provide yet further information. So my goal was to respond to the council's direction to provide you with information on the subject of campaign finance ordinances and these other issues. And I certainly available to respond to questions you might have. I believe the way that the council meeting concluded at your last meeting was I presented the report. At that point, council took comment from the public, and that was where we finished the item at that point.
And that is the case. And then perhaps some of the fuzziness about the last report was because we were trying to tackle that issue at a very late hour. Hence the reason we have advanced this matter tonight so that we can discuss it at a reasonable hour. And but I also listened to the slow span. I listened to your staff report again, and I'll be candid in saying I was a little more awake than the last time when we were debating it at 11.
Okay, I won't take that personally then.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sorry. But Councilmember Clay, I believe you have.
Yeah, I wasn't questioning the your report. I think it was outstanding, but I think we have different people here tonight, possibly. But I do have a question on making a nexus. First off, San Luis is the only city in San Luis Obispo County that has some type of campaign finance reform. Is that not right?
Yes.
Okay. And then also, how do you make the on mandatory campaign reform? How do you make the nexus? Could you cover that?
Yes. The law provides with respect. Are you talking about what the findings are that are required to
support
make an ordinance on limitations?
Yeah, a mandatory.
Yes. That's addressed in the staff report on. I guess big page 191 with regards to and on to 192. I referenced the case of Citizens for Clean Government versus the City of San Diego. That's a federal court decision from the Ninth Circuit. And in that case, the court said that in order to support an ordinance imposing contribution limits, the ordinance should cite specific instances of corruption or other malfeasance in its findings before implementing a mandatory contribution limit. The court further said that mere hypotheticals or statements that contributions may corrupt the system will not meet that test.
Thank you.
Well, Councilmember Luna is up.
Marcia, would you go through how, under the present scheme, how you would go about posting late contribution reports? Reports that the pre-reports 17 days before the election, and anything that's over $1,000 within 24 hours?
As far as you mean on the web?
Yeah.
Well, my plan, since this is the first year we've done this, would be on, like with the 460s that are on there now, and we posted them the day after the deadline that they were due. I would hope that that would work. Again, I haven't done it yet, but so the next filing date is October 6th for candidates. So on October 7th, we would put them on. I would guess like by the end of day, that following day, we should be able to have them on unless there's a problem with this. We had like with the scanner or something, but it should be the next day, I would say, by 5 o'clock.
And anything over $1,000 that's...
For late contributions, yes.
For 24... Within 24
they
hours
have to file them within 24 hours of the either receiving that contribution or making that expenditure, and then whenever I receive it, I would
post it
within 24 hours.
Okay, thank you.
Mayor Pro Tem Bureau.
This question is back with Jerry's question about the findings that you have to make. So all laws that were made before 2007, which is the year that this Clean Government versus City of San Diego, didn't have to make those findings, but forevermore we do have to make those findings. So I think the public is, in talking to some members of the public, they're confused on why we have to make findings for campaign contribution limits now when there's other laws that are already in place.
Well, I'm not going to render an opinion with regard to those other ordinances. I can tell you what the Ninth Circuit said in 2007, and it's 2008 now. So the court was pretty clear about what the required findings are.
So the people who made laws in 2006 and 2005 don't have to go back and make findings, but if a city wants to put the restrictions in place, they do have to make those findings?
Well, I thought I dodged that question the first time, but I guess I didn't do that very well.
Until somebody challenges them, right?
Well, I'm not going to be the one.
So you're open. So you're open to be challenged, is what it implies.
Well, I'm not.
And you're not even going to answer that one either.
I'm not open to be challenged, but I'm not going to render an opinion on whether they are or not. I could refer you to. Let me see if I find it here on page 204 of your packet. This is from the League paper, entitled "A Primer on Local Campaign Regulations." And on big page 204, the paper does reference the Citizens for Clean Government case, and it does confirm what I had indicated in my report, namely, I'll quote from the paper, "The Ninth Circuit held that the district court should not have held as a matter of law that the city had a sufficient interest in justifying the application of its contribution limits. It found that the lower court's reliance on hypothetical situations was insufficient, and it was not derived from any legislative findings and could not be found anywhere in the record. The court remanded the case for the city to provide evidence of a sufficiently important governmental interest." So that's what the League paper concluded. I believe, based on my reading of the case, that that's an accurate statement, that you cannot rely on hypothetical situations, that there is, that there are findings that are required to support an ordinance limiting campaign contributions. Now, having said that, I should mention that there are other options that are available with on this subject of campaign reform that are addressed in the memorandum in the report that I presented to you. The voluntary campaign declaration is one of them. There's the code of ethics is another one as well. So there's basically a number of different issues and options that are available to the council, and I did my best in my report to identify them and discuss the law that applied to each of them.
Thank you.
Reference the code of ethics. This is only good as those who follow it, correct?
Well, that's true with any law, yes.
Yes. And another question is, City of San Diego, have they appealed the Ninth Circuit decision?
I don't know if they appealed it or not. I don't recall. Where you go from the Ninth Circuit is to the U.S. Supreme Court, and to my knowledge, the U.S. Supreme Court has not heard this case. Otherwise, it would have come to my attention. So that is the law now, and to my knowledge, there has not been any change in it.
Are you aware of any cities since 2007, since this opinion was rendered, that have enacted any caps, for instance?
Not to my knowledge, caps. But that doesn't mean there haven't been any. The chart that I provided with the report, which is attachment, it's attachment to the 400 and something cities that are reported there and the 100 that have adopted them. Unfortunately, it doesn't show the year. Well, wait a minute. I do see it does say a date here. Well, then I guess what I'd have to do is go through and check the date. So maybe while you all are talking amongst yourselves, I'll look for that. But if I do have an opportunity to check to see if there's any that have been adopted since, I'll do that and ask for an opportunity to mention that to you.
All right, thank you. Other question, Councilmember Clay?
Yes, you mentioned 400. I believe there's 480 cities. Is that not right? And there's 100 that have some type of campaign reform, finance reform, and that there are several cities that are rescinding their campaign finance reform.
I believe there are two cities. Let me double-check the report. Let's see, the cities of Mission Viejo and Oceanside enacted campaign finance limitation ordinances, and those were repealed. And I was advised that the city of Fairfield is in the process of repealing its campaign finance ordinance.
And was I right with about 480 on the figure?
See, on the number of cities, I believe there are 480 cities in California. Of the 480, 413 are referenced in the chart that was in the report I gave you.
Yeah.
And of that 413, approximately 100 have enacted the campaign finance ordinances.
Thank you.
Councilmember O'Malley?
Of those three cities you cited, do you know the basis for the repealing of the ordinance?
No. But I could make some inquiries to find out if you like. But I did not.
I would actually be interested in that. Mayor Pro Tem Vero?
Just on attachment 2, it says the chart was in 2007, so you're probably not going to find any that's been done since then, so don't bother looking through there.
Well, I did see some dates of 2007. For example, Laguna Beach, I see, was, just in a spot check here, I see Laguna Beach, which is on page 234, apparently adopted a limit of $310 on June 15th of 2007. I'll have to double-check the date that San Diego case was decided to see if it was before or after that. I don't have a specific date that that case was decided other than 2007, but I could find that out.
I had a question, and I posed it to you before, as a reference to contribution caps for individuals, and I just think everybody else should hear it as well. The contribution cap can be imposed on a political action committee and a union and a corporation as well?
Yes.
All right, thank you. Other questions? All right, we will then open it to the public. Welcome.
Thank you. Good evening, council members. My name is David Broadwater, and I do have new information since the last meeting. I'd like to direct your attention to a letter dated today that I have distributed by email to all members of the council and top city staff on the 3rd of this month, entitled Enhanced Campaign Contribution Transparency and Accountability. Now, I've read the staff report as well as the supplemental report that was issued yesterday, as well as the California Municipal Law Handbook, primer on local campaign regulations, ethics law reference for local officials, information from the FPPC and the law, all of which are referenced in this letter that I'm asking to be placed into the record of tonight's meeting. And this letter includes three recommendations, one of which you've already talked about, posting of Form 460s on a citizen on the city's website. Secondly, longer posting period for late contributions of smaller amounts than required under state law, and on-the-record declaration of campaign contributions during meetings. Also cite in this letter, specifically in state law, the city is explicitly granted the authority to enact all of these recommendations in this letter. And I'll be brief on the first one, since it's been discussed and already been acted on by the clerk, and I would like to commend the city clerk for taking the initiative, and that those Form 460 contribution forms are now posted on the website. I urge approval of the city council of the posting as it's now done. And I think that the issues that were raised by the city attorney regarding the complexity, legal jeopardy, and cost have been resolved. So I'd like to spend a little bit more time on the second two. And one of them is, as I understand it, any contributions that are late over $1,000 have to be reported within 24 hours during about the last 2 weeks. But
mail-in ballots in the last election for which there are figures, 53%, a majority of Atascadero voters actually cast their votes by mail-in ballot rather than go into the polls on election day. And so the period for late contributions ought to be extended to 30 days, and we can tailor that down to a threshold of $100 or $250. Finally, state law requires that commissioners declare on the record contributions over $250 that they've received from applicants that appear before them, yet the city council is exempt. And I would like you to require that when an applicant or appellant appears with a financial interest in an agenda item before the city council, and you, any member of the council has received campaign contributions from them, that they're declared on the record.
Thank you.
That's all explained here.
Welcome.
I'm Joan O'Keefe, Atascadero, and I didn't speak before, so I do want to say that I think that posting the 460s on the website will is just a really positive step in the right direction. People will be able to access this information. I also think it's going to make it easier for the clerk and her assistants down there. I remember during the last election, people were down there swarming, literally, up at the desk there, and the clerks were running back and forth, and they would get angry with the clerks because they felt that they were withholding information. And part of the problem was that some of the people didn't know how to ask the right questions, which does bring up one issue, and that is... And this happened to come up during the last election, and that incumbents can start raising money prior to the time that the new applicants can. So therefore, one of the councilmen's 460s was not given to a number of the people, and it had to do with the way the clerk was filing the information. I happened to know that that was the case, and so I asked for it and was able to show them that. So I don't know how you're going to deal with that. Recently, I had to go into the county clerk's office because I wanted to check on the final amounts of money for the 5th District Supervisor. And again, this is one of the problems that most people aren't aware of, and that is that there is a filing period that comes after the election. And during that period of time, a lot of money can be raised. That's just a reality. We have to keep ourselves informed and educated. And believe you me, I got a real eye-opener with regard to a contribution from the Slow Cattlemen's PAC to two of the candidates. The amount of money in there was close to $40,000 from two big contributors. I intend to write a letter to the editor on that. But what I'm saying to the citizens is you really have to be informed. You can find the PACs. Also, county PACs are with the county clerk's office. They are not listed up here. If it's a state PAC, that's on the Secretary of State's website, as well as the Secretary of State also has the information for contributions from all state candidates. So it's kind of spread out, and again, we have to educate ourselves. The media tends to drop the ball after the election is over. I haven't seen anything from the Trib or the Atascadero News. I intend to write a letter. It'll have to be short in order to get it published, but to at least apprise the public of the final amounts of money that have come in. I'm sorry I didn't see that on the 5th District.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Hi, my name is Mark Phillips. I live in Atascadero, and I want to thank Marsha and her staff for putting the Form 460s online. That's great. Looks good, and appreciate her efforts on that. In reading the appendix or addendum, I guess it is, Pyrick, I'm sorry, Mr. Pyrick, put together, I've got to commend the district court for their honesty in saying under number two here, it says that the court did not endorse the goals of equalizing the ability of all citizens to influence electoral outcomes. I guess it's now enshrined in law, then, that the rich will have more voice in government than the poor. That seems to be what that's saying, and I find it pretty amazing. And apparently reducing the skyrocketing cost of political campaigns is also not a sufficient reason. It's pretty amazing to me that whenever the people try to get together and do something that they think is a good idea, makes sense, it turns out to be illegal. And that seems to happen all the time. I'm getting really tired of that. Later on, you say that accepted evidence of corruption, the courts have looked to a variety of information that taken together constitutes sufficient evidence or corruption or the appearance thereof. And then you list several things which taken together might be sufficient findings. So I'd like a little bit of feedback maybe from you or a little clarification on just which is it. Is it impossible unless you find somebody with their hand in the cookie jar? Or can you look at increasing costs, a lot of it from certain economic segments of our society? And if that isn't enough to, again, the appearance of corruption is also apparently a viable purpose for your findings. So I'm still a little unclear on that. I'd like to reiterate some of the things David Broadwater said regarding the late reporting, maybe lengthening the time for that and lowering the trigger from 1,000 down to something significantly less than that. And disclosure of contributions by folks who are coming before this body, I think that's just common sense. We're going to know about it anyway through the Form 460s and other ways. I mean, there'll always be some in the audience that already knows about it. Don't make them bring it up and make it an issue. Just let's have it be part of the thing that we do is, hey, you're before me, you're asking for something, and by the way, you gave me $250 in my last campaign, and thanks, but I may rule against you anyway. And that'll be fine. That'll be it. Be easy. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Lee Perkins, Atascadero. And I want to applaud Marcia for her efforts in getting the 460s online. It will provide more transparency for those that are computer literate at the touch of their fingers. It will save time at the front desk and be paperless. And I'd like to compliment and call your attention to Mark Phillips' presentation of campaign contributions over the last few elections. And I hope you still have copies of that. It did indicate dramatic increases in funding for a city council race. And while it may not be malfeasance, it certainly is a serious concern for many of us. And I hope the city council will consider one of the reforms or options. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good evening. Marty Brown, Atascadero. I would like to commend the city clerk for taking the positive step in initiating posting campaign contributions and expenditure forms on the city's website. This will be a valuable aid in informing all of the voting public of the potential influences on the candidates running for office. Isn't it also incumbent on the donors themselves to report contributions? And how would this be done? If an elected official received a campaign contribution from a donor who has a financial interest in an agenda item that will be approved or denied by a vote of the council, then that recipient must declare on the record that fact, and then the rest of the council will decide whether or not that recipient will be allowed to vote on the donor's issue. This will facilitate more honesty and fairness in which to make our political decisions. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Jim Shannon, Gormar Avenue, Tascadero. Basically, what I'm hearing, what this all comes down to really is ethics and money. No matter what you say or what you're going to vote on tonight, reform or ordinance, whatever it is, it comes down to ethics and money. And I agree with you, Mr. Brindler, ethics comes down to every one of you up there and how you run your campaign and what you do. The money part of it, as far as I'm concerned, nobody up there has ever received a penny from me. None of you ever will receive a penny from me. On election day, what you will get from me and everybody else who goes out today, that day, is our vote, and that's priceless. So all this feel-good stuff that we're talking about here, to me, is a bunch of garbage. I mean, it doesn't matter. I mean, I would like to know how much money we have had our city attorney has been paid to do all this stuff. I mean, it's probably some big dollars there. And in the end, it's not going to really matter. Because it doesn't matter what you pass or what you're going to do, the same people that are up there complaining and wanting this They're going to be back up here 2 years from now, going through the books with a fine-tooth comb and trying to point things out that were good, bad, whatever. I know that they've got on Mr. O'Malley, Mr. Clay, because of money by developers or whatever, but I've never heard anybody say about all the money that Mr. Brindler got from unions. So, again, this to me is just a bunch of garbage, because I sit here and drive down the city streets all the time and see our situation that we're in. We have a lot more things more important to talk about than this, and this is a big waste of time. As far as I'm concerned, there's three up there that want to pass us through and push it through, do it, get it over with, and let's go on to something that's important to the city instead of this feel-good stuff. Thank you.
Welcome.
Tom McGee, Tascadero resident. I hear the word transparency. It's the current hot phrase, buzzword. You hear it everywhere. Enhanced transparency, increased transparency. Transparency is our objective. On and on and on. Transparency is defined as objects can be seen if there were no intervening materials. This proposal is full of intervening materials. What is the real reason behind the change, and what is the motivation behind the change? Oh, it's to enhance transparency or to increase transparency. Transparency is our objective, but it's only for one side, not the other. This enhanced transparency, this increased transparency, is not for controlling campaign financing. But I say it is for controlling campaign financing. It is an attempt to block, control this city council and future city councils, all in the name of increased transparency or enhanced transparency. Why is this transparency must be acted on now? Why stress that this proposal, being this increased in transparency, this enhanced transparency, be acted on before the November election? I believe personally that the answer is very simple. This is not transparency. This is an attempt to control a campaign. I urge that this current city council defer to the next city council rather than pass a lame duck policy that would once again be detrimental to the city and future councils. This is a state law that governs campaign financing. It is referred to numerous times as the minimum state law. I'm sure that the legislatures that crafted this law felt like, okay, let's go out and develop a minimum law. But, of course, changes would be better. Changes would not be better. You would leave a legacy of a lame duck council in the name of increased transparency. And you would do this based on cloudy, disruptive segments from a Tascadero.
Welcome.
Thank you. Nora Trenacosta, Tascadero resident. I just want to echo the commendation of Marcia Torgensen and all she's done to make things easier in this election. It's really felt by the public. I also need to echo the concerns about communication in general. I think to date, ex parte has always focused on communication. There really hasn't been a focus on funding. And I can't begin to touch on the eloquence I heard at this morning's county meeting about how important, how deep the value of transparency is to democracy. So anybody that has, you know, a desire to dig deeper into that, there were some very eloquent speakers there this morning. I am very concerned how, without the benefit of an ordinance, how are we going to maintain that value in preserving access to information for the voters? This council hasn't really risen to the challenge of creating standards of ethics. So voluntary declarations and code of ethics really don't seem sufficient in themselves to get the job done here. There need to be consequences for not following through, and those should be detailed. The key areas of concern, I can echo, I think, many members of the public. Disclosure during meetings, especially anyone who's coming before the body, and late campaign contribution reports, again, those post-election, that's very meaningful. I think ethics and voluntary compliance have failed to take a toehold here with this council, and we need to understand where the accountability is coming from. So I don't know if, perhaps the council can address that or legal counsel can address that, but I'm not hearing a real solution here in terms of, long-term accountability for this. The value of information to the voters and as a vital, vital part of the democratic process is not something to toy with. And I just don't feel that there's a clear idea of what the accountability and what the process is here. So I'm hoping that can be addressed.
Thank you.
Good evening. I'm Tina Santos. And I think we need campaign reform or another McCain fund goal as much as a chicken needs teeth. I recall the last election, my wife and I walk all over Tascadero for exercise, and there's a member up there in the council where the largest signs, looks like in every corner of the city, and those signs do cost money. And I think we're very naive to think that you either honest or you're not. Suppose that somebody wants to give you $1,000 in cash or $2,000, you can track it. That's all there is to it. And I think so much time is wasted there at these city council meetings. We talk about transparency. We talk about reform. And it's just a waste of time, because if you're honest, you're honest. And I think in the country they live, that we still have freedom. If somebody wants to give you a big chunk of money so that you run, go right ahead. More power to you. And there's been a lot of rumors about, I have to clarify too. People ask me, do you work for Walmart or do you have any stock? The answer is no. I'm just a customer there. So when I come here and I defend Walmart, it's not because I work there. It's because I like to shop there. But just keep this in mind, that you're either honest or you're not. And if there's been a lot of accusations that anti-Walmart haters get a lot of support from the unions, it would be interesting to know if they are willing to stand up here and tell the truth. Do they get money from the unions? Do they get support from the unions who are anti-Walmart? And we need to know that. But I think we waste a lot of time over here just talking about campaign reform and all that. So what? If somebody wants to give you some money, take it and run. Be honest. If you're not honest, you're not honest. But if you're honest, you're going to be honest. And as I said, to protect the guilty party, there's one of you who sit up there where the biggest signs all over Tascadero the last election, and that person was elected. And those signs are not printed for pennies. Thank you.
Welcome.
Roberta Fonzi, a Tascadero resident. I'm concerned about the findings, and I heard several of you mention that there needed to be findings made, and I would hope that the council will be very careful when they do this, if they're thinking about campaign finance reform, to carefully make these findings, because I am afraid we could be brought into legal jeopardy and have lawsuits against our city that will be very expensive in a time when we really don't have the money to fight them. I was concerned when I heard the city attorney talk about limits on contributions, but no limits on expenditures. I think that there's an unintended consequence that needs to be considered to this. If there's no limit on expenditures, it means that someone could come in and self-finance. Someone with a lot of money can go in and not have to raise those contributions, whereas I've heard several of you state that the reason you're concerned about campaign finance is you want to make sure that the little guy has a chance. I think that because there's no limit on expenditures, but there could be a limit placed on contributions, you may be making it harder for that little guy to compete with the guy who has the money. So if you have a common citizen, he may or may not be able to raise enough money with a very small contribution limit. I think it's been raised before, but it needs to be said again. When there's a limited amount of money that's available to a person who is running for office, they often will take a more dramatic approach to getting their message out, because it's very expensive to get out ads and put out signs and do other things, and they may resort to negative campaigning, which would be exactly what you do not want to promote. I've heard you state time and again you'd like to have well-run campaigns with good, high ethical standards, but if a person has a very limited amount of money, they're going to go for what will give them the most bang for the buck, which may be the negative campaign.
I think it should be considered that there are many people who do not have the time to stand in front of stores and do the things that volunteers would like to be able to do if they're working in a business or have to work for a living, and they are the ones that often give the money in place of the time. I think it would be helpful if you're going to talk about full disclosure and transparency that you also put some kind of a monetary amount on the hours that a person volunteers, because time is money, and a person that volunteers in front of a store to hand out flyers or do other things actually is giving something to that person that they're campaigning for. And lastly, I'd like to talk about reporting requirements. I would hope that you wouldn't make those reporting requirements very onerous. The people who run for office, and particularly on the city council end, are volunteers with other jobs. And if they have to make a 24-hour reporting go down and do an overnight mail after jobs on something as small as $100 or $250, it will be a hardship, and you may lose candidates that do not have the time or the energy to do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good evening again. And the staff report was tremendous. And I think I've written before in our newsletter, you know, it was over 2 inches thick and lots to digest. And I'm glad you're taking your time to review all of this. And I, too, was encouraged by that we do have to create findings, or we have to make findings showing that there has been some malfeasance or improprieties done in order to enact a campaign reform. And it just seems that we're going in a direction where we don't want to put the city at risk. It's not worth it at this point. And it sounds like you had some great questions for the attorney to answer. And I would just encourage you to again, keep our options open, keep doing the research, and take our time on this, and let's wait for some of those answers before enacting anything this evening. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments from the public? Seeing none, we'll return it to the council. We have questions, comments. Actually, Mr. Pierick, there was, a question raised by one of the speakers. Mr. Phillips, I believe. Do you recall?
Well, the question that I have in mind that was raised by, I think, a couple of speakers were the findings that are required. I pulled up the Citizens for Clean Government versus San Diego case that is referenced in the staff report. The date of decision of that case is January 19th, 2007. And in terms of the statement by the court that I think is most instructive there, appears it's like in the second paragraph to the end of the opinion, the court states, "We cannot hold that hypotheticals accompanied by vague allusions to practical experience demonstrate a sufficiently important state interest. And while relevant to the analysis, the city's statement of purpose only vaguely articulates a risk of corruption." In the next paragraph, "We make no statement about whether the city on remand," which is what happens when it goes back to the trial court, "will be able to develop and introduce evidence establishing a sufficiently important interest in limiting contributions to recall campaigns." And I would couple that with a reference to big page 204, which is the league paper on campaign contribution ordinances. And at that page at the top, the author cites to the Citizens for Clean Government case, the one that I've mentioned, and I've already referenced the summary about how hypothetical situations are not sufficient. And then there's this practice tip that appears in the middle of page 204, and if I could just read that, quoting a practice tip, "When imposing contribution limits, develop legislative findings in support of the regulation that its purpose is to combat corruption or the appearance of corruption, and if possible, cite specific instances of campaign violations. Anecdotal evidence may be helpful as well, but will probably not suffice on its own. If the contribution limit is later challenged, the legislative findings and other supporting evidence will be a critical part of your record upon which the court will rely in deciding whether or not to uphold the contribution limit." And I should mention that, as referenced in both my report as well as in the leak paper, that one of the significant factors in evaluating campaign ordinances is the fact that there are constitutional implications here with regard to the First Amendment. So that is why these ordinances are viewed with strict scrutiny by the courts, to make sure that there's adequate justification. And I believe that answers the question that dealt with the issue of findings. Was there any other issue?
Well, I think that's the point he was making, Mr. Phillips was making, was that it's a sad state of affairs when it's you have to get your hand caught in the cookie jar simply to do something proactive and stem what many believe in this country to be a real systemic problem with campaigns in general. And I am very sensitive to that issue as well. I think we are in a sorry state of affairs nationwide with the way campaigns are run and the way they are financed. Do we have other comments or questions? I don't.
Yes.
Councilmember Clay.
I think we've got a great country. I think we, I can't criticize. Sure, campaign finance is a lot of money spent on it. That's our system. People that sell ads, signs, that money is turned back in the community. But I always think about what John Wooden said about teachers and all. And he said, no written word or books on the shelf is worth what the person is himself. And I don't think any amount of money or amount of science is as important as the person himself that's running for office. I don't think we should do anything with this. I think it's working. I know Mayor Brenner is set on something happening here. I don't agree with it. We have these two factors. We have the business community and the environmental community, and we go back and forth. The environmental community raised a lot of money too. If we're going to report people that maybe have something on the agenda and they've received or given money to one of the council members, then we should do the exact opposite. Anyone that's a naysayer, opposed to things all the time, then that money should be disclosed. I think the system's working. I think we're getting into an area here that we shouldn't, and we're close to election time, and it's just going to create confusion. Things will get done. We haven't had a problem in the past. I think Mayor Brenner himself got elected with, $11,000 or something like that, which is a small amount compared to some of the other people that ran. And the money doesn't always get you elected. I pride myself on, getting a seat with 6,500 the first time I run and around 10,000 the last two times. So money doesn't get you elected. It's who the person is himself. And you have to have some money to get that across. So let's just leave this alone.
I'll give you an example in a second, Jerry. Councilmember O'Malley.
Thank you. I want to begin with a story of my first campaign year, and there's a number of comments I'd like to make, having worked on this topic for some time. But, of course, being someone born and raised in Atascadero, like I always say when I first ran, hey, a degree in economics, a degree in counseling ought to be perfect for city council. I was very politically naive 6 years ago when I ran, and two things I experienced. All of a sudden, I saw ads in the paper by an organization called the Atascadero Homeowners Association. You'll never find a Form 460 filed by that organization, but they were kind of saying, well, Tom O'Malley's a bad person, and I'd have folks come up to me saying, well, you're in George Luna's back pocket. There's that. And then on the other same time, I was invited to a meeting on the other end of the political spectrum of conservatives, maybe 40 or 50 businessmen and folks sat around the circle and said, well, we know Bob Kelly and we know Mike Arambidi, and there's not enough money in this town to support more than two candidates, so you're kind of out of luck. And that's when I said, you know, I'm running for city council, and I made a family decision, we're running. And so I found myself, homegrown boy, first time, literally running against both extremes at the same time. So welcome. I think you think you won't be there, a couple of candidates in the audience, but it's amazing how it's bad enough to be getting one label, but when you actually get labeled by both groups as being in the opposite camp, it's a little shocking. But that was my first experience, and I think it's unfortunate that we do have a political pendulum swing in our town, and I think we just have to resist that. And I commend a new folks coming in to taking a shot at this, and it's, you know, you just have to stay your course and do what you believe is right. Now, we've studied campaign issues for some time. I like that Ellen Barrow and I have been on a committee looking at this. We had several consultants look at this. I'm very concerned that we did consider as a council two examples of communities that implemented a campaign reform strategy. There was one community that took a number of years to implement the plan, and it's still in place, and it has some long-term benefit to that community. The other example that was shared when we began this a year and a half ago was a community that had a council majority that pushed through some ideas, and it was on a kind of a win-lose approach rather than in the other community. They did it unanimously, and sure enough, it failed after the next election. It was reversed, and this is what's an experience in a number of communities where they get reversed, is it's not done by consensus. It's back to that pendulum swing, win-lose. And we need to look for a win-win solution in our community. We need to get back to understanding that we need to make our diversity work for us rather than against us, and I still think we can do that. I have always wanted to focus on the code of ethics part around the accusation area, and I want to read of something that we all sign as candidates. I shall not use or permit the use of character defamation, whispering campaigns, libel, slander, or scurrilous attacks on any candidates or his or her personal or family life. And I think what I have seen that's the most detrimental in a community is when there's a lot of attacks, innuendos, unfounded accusations, and there's not an avenue to respond to those. And what I have found, and if you look at the research on campaign issues nationwide, you'll find statistically it takes a lot more money to counteract a negative campaign. I like my good friend Steve Martin used to say, there's a reason why nice guys finish last is because they go by the rules. He uses an example of being in track up here in our high school. He noticed when he'd always finish the whole course, he'd notice other folks taking shortcuts and kind of getting in ahead. And I think if you're going to follow the rules, it can take you more work. And what I noticed myself having to twice when I've been in a campaign, refusing to take a negative route, focusing on issues, focusing on positives, and trying to undo negative campaigning, it costs a lot more money, and that's verified by any research into campaigning. So I think that's something we have to address. What I'm really concerned about, I completely support full disclosure. The problem is you've got some folks like myself that disclose all contributions, all expenditures. When I get in-kind contributions of folks doing a website, it's shown. When I have someone contributing labor to do a brochure, I report it. Yep, that does pump up the costs that are displayed, but then we have situations, again, I mentioned the Tascadero Homeowners Association, when you have organizations that are providing websites or doing mail-outs in the community, and those costs have an impact, but they're not reported. You won't find a Form 460 that shows those costs in the last election. Well, that has an impact, and that means it's not a level playing field. So the problem is how can we get in a community where everyone reports? And if we could get to that, I think then we could have a fair challenge in the community, and that's something I want to try to work on. And it was mentioned about volunteer time. Of course, that's another thing that tends to impact on campaigns. But I'm more concerned about actual expenditures made that aren't reported. I think we've got to address that. You know, I think it's important to remember, I always say, campaign contribution. It's not like you get to take it home, you know. It's like if you look, yeah, there's contributions and there's expenditures. You see where the money came from. You see where the money went. And what I actually feel pretty good about is now and then you hear folks attacking different ones of us for a campaign contribution. But, you know, you really haven't, I haven't heard any attacks on my voting record, which I think, you know, if there was a, something to attack, don't you think we'd hear about it in our community? And in times before when this topic has come up, I have responded about some campaign contributions, and it's been kind of funny to some of my campaign supporters because more than half point out to me a little bit with a chuckle that I've actually voted against their projects. As I used to say, thank you, Dennis Maresco, for your contribution. However, the only project ever came before us I voted against. Thank you, Andy Charnley, for your contribution. Unfortunately, when we actually doubled impact fees and it cost him $85,000 the time he had a project before us. So, you know, I think whether you disclose contributions or not, I don't think it really matters. The fact is, look at a person's voting record. I think that will answer that question. What I see happening when you start to try to push in, basically not have accountability for some folks that are involved in campaigning in a community and put restrictions on others, you start creating what we're starting to do in our community, some unintended consequences. We are bringing big-time politics into our little town by these kind of restrictions because just in the last 2 years, do you know how many legal political action committees have been created that have an impact in our community? We got Oppose Walmart, you got the Shield Initiative, you got the responses to those, two more. You've got a Better Atascadero. You've got Home Builders Association. You know, there's a lot of political action committees in our community, and they are getting more and more involved. And I think that's going to be a challenge for, again, us independent folks trying to run for a council seat, and you've got more of this kind of activity. I think the most important thing to me is, okay, let's look at accountability for what we say. I'm really tired of the negative campaigning that's gone on in our community, the accusations that are made, and folks aren't held accountable for those accusations. I think we need to keep track of those, and we need a way for folks to have a way to respond to those so that everyone can be judged fairly. I would like to see a way that everyone can be accountable for expenditures made out there in the community, but we can't control folks that don't report information, unfortunately. But we can at least hold folks accountable for what they say and allegations against other council members. Let's follow through on those. So that's what I think is the important thing, and I don't see us addressing those yet.
Tell us what you really think, Tom.
Thank you.
Does it say anything in that ethics pledge about inviting another council member to the parking lot?
Does it say anything about in there about poking someone in the face and in the arm?
Well, that is an outright lie, and you know it, and I know it. And then Mr. and all the people that were present know that I did not assault you in any way. That story morphed from me pointing my finger at you.
Can we
do an
point
assault.
Of order? Can
hey,
we get back to
we're
the?
We're getting off track here, folks. This is getting personal.
Point taken. Mayor Pro Tem Barreau.
Okay, so this is a management report, so we really can't take any action tonight. So if anyone's thinking we're going to take action tonight, we're not. We're just giving direction to staff on what we're interested in pursuing. So I came up with, as a candidate, you get a lot of contributions in that last month, and I think it would be beneficial for the public to get another full report maybe on, like, August 21st, which is just a couple weeks ahead of the of the election, because the Form 460 will report anything that's over $100, and so that makes it very clear, because a lot of people don't even clue into the campaign until the last month. So if you get that last report, it doesn't really tell you the whole story. So if there's another additional full report prior to the election, so I'm interested in that topic. Another one is I saw in many cities is that there are no contributions the last 8 days before the election. So that cuts out late reporting the last eight days of the election, because there is no contributions being made the last 8 days of the election. So I'm interested in that. there was some discussion, and I would support any declarations of contributions over $250, which an applicant is coming before you. This would be equivalent to rules for the Planning Commission. If they had run for a city council position and had received a contribution of $250 or more, they would have to declare that at a Planning Commission meeting.
For the first year.
For the first year. Okay. So I think those rules would be fair on the city council as well. And, you know, I had thought about that as well. You know, not everybody goes to the web and looks at 460s. And I want a couple minutes here. Declarations made at a public meeting, even though it's available on the 460 on the web, not everybody comes. Usually people come to a council meeting for their one issue, and they may listen to another item on the agenda and not have done their homework. And so it does benefit the public that's in attendance at that meeting that night. I think it could be easily rolled into the ex parte communications time period of an item. And, you know, I think eventually it will discourage the extra-large donations being given to candidates, because if you're an applicant and you see this potential financial conflict, it will discourage you from giving large donations to candidates. And if we're trying to keep the cost of campaigns down, you don't want people to get large donations, because it can skew the average person from getting elected. I think we need to continue the 460s. I think we need to endorse Marcia's efforts. I do think we do should include the mid-year ones, not just the ones during campaign season, because we do have incumbents that that run. And just for future topics, I've pondered the idea of term limits, code of ethics, which we started working on but never really got anywhere. And we need to continue to work with our Public Trust Committee. And I want to remind everyone that the City Council has already done quite a bit working on public trust, and we have agreed to hosting some debates that will be televised. And one of those debates will get into, it's called the Last Word Forum, which is right before the election, which will give all the candidates a time to rebut some of the negative campaigning. Hopefully there won't be any, but you never know. And I really liked how Tom brought up the I had it marked, the one that everybody signs that says, you know, I'm going to be ethical. And then on number 6, it says, I shall immediately and publicly repudiate support deriving from any individual or group, like a PAC, which resorts on behalf of my candidacy or in opposition to that of my opponent to the methods and tactics which I condemn. So if someone's doing smear ads for you, you're expected to repudiate them. I shall take responsibility to take firm action against any subordinate who violates any provision of this code or the laws governing elections. And so the state of California has made it very clear that fair campaigns are important, and we need to support that. And that's why one of the reasons why we decided to hold those forums, to try to level the playing field. So I'd like to hear from other council members on what they also would like staff to bring back.
Councilmember Luna.
Marcia, Councilmember O'Malley mentioned the number of PACs that have been created in Atascadero in the last few years. Well, let's be specific to Atascadero. Why don't you go through the qualification or the amount of money raised limit for filing a 460?
That's what I'm saying. Every committee type of committee is different, but some of them are quarterly, some of them are semi-annual. But at those time periods, you have to file the 460, even if you've just collected, you know, $25.
So, somebody like an organization, a local organization, social group, or whatever, that is formed or was formed, is already in existence, has a website. And how much money are they allowed to raise before it triggers some kind of requirement to file a form with you, a 460 or whatever?
You know, I didn't bring my committee information here with me. I have my candidate information here. I know candidates. Actually, I was going to mention, I think it was Joan O'Keefe who mentioned during the public comment about the fact that incumbents can collect money before regular candidates. And actually, that's not true. Anyone who wants to run for office can file a Form 501, which is a candidate intention statement, and that is before you collect or spend any money. So you could do that in May, even though the filing period starts in July, and you could start collecting money. And then if you collected up to $1,000 or more, you would then have to come in and file a 410. And then after that, you have to file the 460s on the particular filing dates, the semiannual or quarterly, depending if you're a committee or not. So the same holds for committees. Again, there's different committees, and I don't have that memorized as far as the different types of committees. I can answer your question, you know, after I look that up, if you would like. I just don't know it off the top of my head.
Okay. Well, the assertion made by Councilmember O'Malley is that the Atascadero Homeowners Association had done something wrong because they had not filed a 460.
I think what I was saying is that we don't know what they've spent. We do see ads in the paper. You could figure out what the costs of those. You can see websites. You can see mail outs.
So we don't know.
And that's the thing.
We don't know.
We don't know how much they spent. They didn't file.
Discuss the suggestions by Mayor Pro Tem Barreau. I think a voluntary expenditure limit is if we could come up with a number on the city council, 50 cents per, you know, $13,000 or something like that is a reasonable amount, and just said that, then I think it would probably have no effect. I'll say it now. I think it's a reasonable amount. As far as the late contribution amount, in the staff report, you talk about the state law requires a final pre-election campaign contribution report to be filed no later than 12 days before the election. So no later than 12 days before the election, but it could be that could be extended? I mean, it says no later, so it could be...
As far as when you'd have to... I'm not sure I understood the question. As far as when you'd have to file a late contribution...
This is the late contribution report.
The late contribution report.
So this is page 196.
Oh, I'm not looking in the staff report. I'm actually looking in my... Let me get back here. You have to file a late contribution report if you receive $1,000 anytime in the last 16 days before the election. So
and that
could be, let's say someone gave you $500 a month ago, and now just 10 days before the election they give you another $500, then you need to file a late contribution report.
And that has to be filed no later than 12 days before the election, it says.
I'm not sure what that's referring
to. This is page 196. I guess it's the city attorney's.
Pose the question.
Okay, on page 196, it says state law requires a final pre-election campaign contribution report to be filed no later than 12 days before an election for the period ending 17 days before the election.
Correct.
Now, the point was made that a lot of people use absentee ballots in the county, in Atascadero in particular. And so could that be extended?
Yes.
So we have the discretion to require that reporting be done earlier?
Yes.
Okay. Is that what you were suggesting? So a number would be nice.
Call them early contributions. Say, call them early contributions, George.
Well, I think you suggested August 21st or something like that.
Just to clarify what I said is that either that you extend the late contribution period or that you require a full 460 report on the October 21st.
October, okay.
Yeah.
What do you mean full?
Just like we do them quarterly, or just so you capture all contributions over $100.
doesn't that happen? There's when you're coming up to a campaign, there's several additional
taking contributions. People on the Planning Commission taking contributions from, and then running for office from people who had come before them with the project. And it's always bothered me that the council doesn't have to live by those same rules. And so I could support that. And I certainly endorse all the efforts that Marcia has made in trying to post this on the web. And I recognize that it has not been easy. It's something that looks obvious to me. In fact, I've often thought about doing it myself. But I think that it's much better having it on the city website and having it be official. As far as the future efforts go, well, that will be left to a future council. I think we would have a hard time making the findings. I hope we would have a hard time making the findings that are necessary to limit campaign contributions. That is, I hope that the elections that I have participated in and that the other elections in Atascadero have been honest and would not require the necessity of campaign contribution limits or campaign limits on campaign expenditures. So with that, I'll wait to hear from the rest of the council.
Councilmember Clay.
Yes. In regards to the last 8 days, I mean, that's when you figure out, man, I'm short of money or I'm this or that, and you've got to go out and hustle a little bit and collect some money to pay the bills. So, not allowing any contributions the last 8 days, that's going to kind of when you finalize things and so on. Danville is a little bitty town. Is that not right, Ryan? It's up in Northern California?
I don't know the size.
Yeah, it's small, real small. But so are you telling me that that 50 cents per person in Atascadero, is that what you're saying? And so the limit would be 13,000?
14,000.
So that's the most we could spend. You realize
that,
now.
That would be a voluntary, as I understood, that would be a voluntary mm-hmm. Threshold, so to speak, yeah. Where we would the council would basically agree that that's about what people should spend.
Right here.
So if people spend three times that, then we know that
wouldn't bother me. But Ellen, that's only half of what you collected last time. You got 26,000, right?
Well, a lot of that was in kind donations, and it gets counted twice. But if everyone has to do the same amount, then that makes it fair, right? Right, because in the race I did, we all tried to raise as much money as we could so we could buy as much advertising, et cetera, et cetera. Now, with the voluntary expenditure limits, you know, the city can provide incentives to create, you know, the will to follow that. And I don't know if you guys read through some of the examples that were in Brian's packet. But, we can post things on our website that said the candidate voluntarily chose to comply with the city's efforts for fair campaigns. So there's incentives that we would also have to include with the voluntary expenditure limits and something that someone signs. And, of course, if the person you're running against violates it, you can choose to not follow it yourself to, try to make things fair again. But the point is to try to set an expectation that we're not going to spend $40,000 on a campaign. We're not going to necessarily have the money to do primetime TV spots because that gets to be really expensive stuff.
Yeah.
So
it hasn't been done.
Well, the way it's been escalating, that's you raise the bar every campaign. You know, it wasn't done, I didn't do it, but, you raise the bar every time. It gets a little more professional. I guess, you start bringing in, outside help. Last time it was the websites. That was kind of the new thing for us, was the websites. So every time, it gets a little more expensive. So that was just an explanation on that.
So I was wondering, on your $26,000, how much was in kind?
I don't remember, like seven?
Okay, seven.
So it was, minus seven out of
On my campaigns, I just focus on my qualifications, what I've contributed to the community. I try to let people know where I stand, and they'll always know where I stand. And I don't care if somebody spends $25,000 or $30,000 on their campaign, if that's what they want to do. I don't think because a person gives $1,000 to somebody, they're necessarily a bad person. You know, maybe they just agree with the direction that person is.
I'll just weigh in here on this this issue of posting 460s on the city website. I think that's the appropriate thing to do. I think it's a great convenience to the public. And the public is becoming more and more interested in who is financing candidates. And I urge the public, as we march into the election season, to continue to be vigilant and really take a hard look at who is propping up the various candidates. I think it's an important issue. And so I'm very happy to see us getting to the point where we're posting the 460s. I also have no problem any of these public documents that candidates fill out, the economic interest statements. I have absolutely no qualms with having that information posted on the website as well. I think it's valuable information that citizens can use to assess the candidates and what they perceive as the candidate's integrity. The issue of this issue of late reporting late contributions, I think it's important. And I mentioned that I was going to give an example to you, Jerry. Last election, there was a candidate that in the waning days of the campaign received, I think it was approximately $5,000 from a prominent developer in this town. And, you know, I personally have to think that that didn't necessarily convey something to me that I thought was good in politics.
Is he sitting on the council?
He lost the election.
It doesn't matter whether he's sitting on the council or not, or whether he lost the election. The issue is the behavior. I have a problem with that type of behavior, and if there's anything that we can do to at least allow the public to see what's going on as far as late contributions, I think it's important, and I fully support it. I'd like that trigger to be $250 personally. This issue of on-record disclosure of campaign contributions, what's the harm? What's the harm in stating before you hear an issue, particularly on a development, that this particular individual may have made a contribution to you? What's the harm? People may want to know that, and I think it's, I do, as a citizen, I think it's important if somebody made a contribution and the politician is going to hear their project, I think it's appropriate for the people to know that that individual has made a contribution, particularly if it's a sizable contribution. So all these 3 points that were raised in Mr. Broadwater's email or letter to us, I support each and every one of those. I will go on the record as saying that I also support contribution caps, although clearly there is some potential litigation there if we were to march down that road. But I hope that ultimately this country will tackle this problem again, and we see it nationwide that campaign finance reform is important to the people of America, and they recognize that there are problems in our political process, and I hope ultimately that we make some headway. But the issues that Mayor Pro Tem Bayrou raised in her discussions earlier, I support all of those, and I would like to go that direction. That's my comments. And
my light's on.
My light's on.
Councilmember O'Malley, it looks like you're up here.
Thank you. And again, I don't see a distinction between in-kind contributions or financial contributions. The irony is the one we hear a lot about is the Rotman Group. That was an in-kind contribution, and it was four folks at $250 each, which came to $1,000. But I actually did a fundraiser at $250 each. But I think those are some things that will be addressed. I don't I don't think actually any limits have any particular impact. What I'm concerned about is, again, the things that are outside of our area, folks that make contributions that aren't reported. And I'd like to ask the attorney some, just to use a couple examples. I could use Ellen or I just interchangeably on this. We both have our own businesses, in a sense. But I know I really appreciated the first campaign. I had folks that I'd gone to school with, unbeknownst to me, actually just took out an ad in the paper. George Simmons owns Hoover's, met him in sixth grade. He took out an ad, said, "Known Tom O'Malley forever, he's a great guy, vote for him," paid for by George Simmons. You can't really put any restriction on any private individual in the community, and it doesn't count in terms of any campaign. There's no limitation on private individuals doing whatever they do individually. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct, and I believe that is addressed in the leaked out.
So I think that's personally why I don't think it has much impact. I would actually support some of these areas if we could somehow make it apply to those folks that don't currently report. But I don't think there's a way to deal with that. So I think the way to protect the freedom of others to respond to folks that don't play by the rules is to keep more options open. So I can't support this and I think the direction you're going. I do think I would support some of the any reporting of things that are already mandated. I think that's good and getting that on the web and reporting things without being a burden on the candidate, like late contributions. I think anything like that is fine. Like you say, a late I've never gotten $5,000, but as we said, the person lost. But, hey, if that's reported earlier somehow, if I don't want to be a burden to the city clerk or to, as Roberta Fonzi said, folks that are really doing this while working a job or anything else, I think we need, some period of time, 3 days or something. But I might support something as far as just reporting things that are already required.
Marcia, do you have?
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure, I think maybe it wasn't clear. When you're talking about filing the 460s during the campaign, there are the two pre-election filing periods. This year it's October 6th, October 23rd. October 23rd is that 12 days before the election. But if you receive, currently the way the state law says, if you receive $1,000 or more after that October 23rd filing of the 460, you need to file a late contribution report, which is a 497. It's a completely different form.
Right.
I just want to make sure you understand. I got the feeling you were thinking you had to file a 460 at
no.
The late ones. It's a separate form.
Could you put those on the website? Because that is a 24-hour requirement.
Right.
And there's no reason. In
that's
fact, you may have been
on
planning on doing that. So
yeah, anything that's filed for, as far
so
as money.
So it's
going to
be reported anyway. I support that.
But what triggers that is $1,000, correct?
Correct.
And do we have the option of applying a trigger of, let's say, $250?
I can jump check with the city attorney, but I believe we can. You can adopt a smaller maximum.
Can I have the question again?
What triggers this late reporting? What was the form number?
497. The late
497 is $1,000, and I'm wondering if we can reduce the trigger to $250.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I addressed that on page 196, big page 196 of the staff report. And there are cities that have, in fact, lowered the limit, and you can do that.
So answer, that is permissible.
The answer, short answer is yes.
Then I would fully support that. Mayor Pro Tem, I'm sorry, Councilmember Luna, you're next.
Marcia, in the case of the $5,000 contribution, that was a late contribution, and when was that posted? Was it posted after the election?
I think it was actually.
I honestly don't remember.
I'd have to.
I think it was after the election.
It wouldn't have been picked up anyway.
Right. It came in the waning days of the election. There was a $2,000 contribution and a $3,000 contribution, as I recollect.
Well, they would be reported under these new guidelines because they would have been over 1,000, and they're going to report them the next day.
And that's the very information that I think the electorate deserves to have before they render their vote.
And that's what we've all agreed that we're going to support, and the city clerk's already said she's going to do that. That's already required that you have to do a, within 24 hours, you have to report anything over 1,000, and now we're going to have it posted on the web.
And that would include, like I said, even if somebody had given you 250 before,
right.
250, you know.
It's cumulative.
And now this made it 1,000, then you still have to file a late contribution report if it's
right.
a cumulative up to 1,000 or over 1,000.
So that's cumulative really for the whole calendar year. If somebody gave you whatever they gave you from January 1st on, and then they gave you $999, and then they gave you a dollar after October 23rd, they would have to, within 24 hours, report to you, and it would be on the web. Right now, it's required they'd have to report it, but now you're also actually going to put it on the web.
Correct.
And that's at the $1,000 threshold.
That's at a buck
but
if they've already
hit. And getting back to the issue is I'm supporting that trigger goes at 250.
Yeah, I still have the floor. I want to ask... That would take a ordinance or some kind of revision to the municipal code.
It would take an ordinance. Yes. I don't think it would take a revision. I don't think you have an existing ordinance on it. So if you're going to revise what is otherwise required by state law, yes, you'd have to do an ordinance.
And required findings for that ordinance?
No.
No.
Well, I'll tell you what. Let me get you back to you on that one.
I have Council Member Clay, and then.
I think, and I want to go back to George.
It's right.
Hey.
It doesn't matter. Council Member Clay, go ahead.
Okay, here we go. I think, George, when you talked to Marcia about the Homeowners Association, and she was talking about, I think you were mixed up a little bit. I mean, the $1,000 threshold is for PACs, right, also?
I have the manual on my desk.
Well,
why don't you report back next council meeting,
because
we can't have anything until...
The question was, is the Atascadero Homeowners Association a PAC?
No, they're not registered.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, you're not called a political action committee until you have filed.
So there you have it.
Okay. I mean,
that's my point. We don't know. Yeah. They don't file.
The other thing, Mike, in regards to people that give you money and then they bring something forward, someone always lets you know that this is happening, but I think it's just as important for getting money from a business or an organization that wants to stop something, and I'm going to refer to you. You've got money from the grocery union, and then you voted on the Walmart thing and never disclosed it. And the grocery union is noted for being against the Walmart thing. In fact, they spend $35 million a year just to stop
Walmart. I don't have any problem.
You're interrupting Councilman Clay.
No, I mean, I don't have any problem with divulging that.
Why don't you let him finish his statement?
But you didn't, though. That's my point. Okay. Anyway, well, that's past history. But anyway, I'm not for any of this stuff, okay? We're too close to election time. It'll work. Things will work out fine. We're going to get three new council members, regardless of what we do here tonight. And maybe one old one if things go right. So I don't support any of this.
All right. Mayor Pro Tem Bayrell.
Okay. I wanted to jump in a couple of times, and I kept holding back. So when we talk about late contributions and we say we want to extend the period to 30 days, that's just to alert people before the last filing if people have made those large contributions. Is that right? Is that what David Broadwater was getting at in his report?
I actually am not sure what the 30 days is, because your last filing that you're required to make by the state is 23 days before the election,
okay.
The 460. So the late contribution reports are after that.
Okay. So we'll just drop that part of it, I guess, for now. And, you know, some of the concerns we have, you know, about PACs and all the myriad of issues around campaigns. We can't control over them, and we can't control all of them. We only can control ourselves, and that's what we're trying to do tonight. We're trying to control ourselves and model behavior for the community. So just to throw up our hands and say we're going to do nothing, I don't think is responsible. When you look at other cities who have done campaign reform, they've done it in a series of steps. They don't get to the perfect thing right away. If you look at the city of San Luis Obispo, who's our nearest city who's done this, they've had like three or four revisions already. And you know, I look to them as an example. So I don't expect for us to solve the problem tonight. And I wasn't really expecting to put everything in place by this election. I think the fact that we already have the 460s on the web is a big step for our city. And if we can just come back and give staff some direction tonight, come back, discuss it some more, it probably will not take effect. But it does bring this important issue to the limelight of our community. It's being broadcast to our community, and it will raise the awareness of what our city is dealing with, and hopefully the people who will be voting this campaign season will be taking their job very seriously and looking at the information that's available to them at the time. So to review what I think, one more topic, the no contributions 8 days before the election. I think since we've all been candidates, we all know that a lot of people don't pay attention to the campaign season until like the last 3 days of the election. So when we spend money as a candidate, you spend most of your money that last weekend. And so that's where the big money crunch comes in. And when you think about it, it's all about name recognition. It's all about throwing your name out there. And that's when all the shenanigans can go on. That's when all the negativity goes on. It's just a crazy time. And I think what the city of Danville, and I didn't remember it was Danville, but you brought that to my attention, the intent dream, and I think it would be a great step for our community.
Councilmember Luna?
How about the rules for the Planning Commission and the Council?
You keep clearing the lights, and I have to keep re-pushing the button.
You dropped that
again.
One.
That's the Declaration of Ex Parte, greater 250, which is the same as the Planning Commission rules.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So basically you have these three items.
Four against an item?
There's four. There's four. Voluntary expenditure limits, late contribution filing threshold lowered to 250, declaration of ex parte, and endorsing the 460s to include mid-year filings as well as just the campaign season.
Okay. Let me make a comment. That I think I support all four of those, at least looking at them. I have a different philosophy when it comes to running for council, and that is that Typically, I will spend the early part of the campaign raising money, and I don't spend anything after October that I don't already have in the bank. So those last 8 days, it would not affect me at all, because if I was going to be on the radio or TV or whatever spots, I would already have the money to pay for those. So I don't think I've ever collected anything in the last 8 days of a campaign. At least I haven't gone out and tried to collect money. Certainly if somebody gave me... Well, actually, I've refused some contributions. But if somebody tried to give me money, it typically came in before October. Actually, the key date was always the date when people actually started voting with absentee. That's the key date that I always used. But I can support all looking at all four of what you suggest.
Marcia?
Sorry, one more thought. I think what Mr. Broadwater was talking about when you asked the question about the 30 days was because of all mail ballots. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but that was why he was suggesting the earlier reporting, because of people voting earlier. And I have told all the candidates that have applied that excuse me, that the all-mail ballots are going out on Monday, October 6th. And the county clerk has told me that she usually gets the majority of them back by Thursday or Friday.
Right.
So people pretty much who get those fill them out and put them right back in the mail. So I've encouraged all of them to take that into consideration when they're doing their advertising or whatever, because as it was mentioned, over 50% of Atascadero residents who are registered vote by mail. So you might want to keep that in mind as you move through this process.
So if we change the late contribution reporting to 30 days prior, does that capture and give more information to the absentee ballot people?
Well, 30 days from the October 23rd would be September 23rd, basically, you're saying?
No, it was 30 days before the election. So if it's November 2nd, it would be October 2nd. So if you have the late filing requirement, I'm just wondering if that will that do the job, or should we just keep it the way it is?
Just leave it the way it is.
I'm thinking that you should leave it the way it is. The late filing is for just those days before the election.
Right.
I think
right.
you try and
okay.
get before the ballot.
That's why I dropped it, because it didn't seem
okay.
like
you're
it was
right.
going to work.
And perhaps maybe this is an education issue for those people that would be inclined to turn in their absentee ballot immediately. Maybe this will be an opportunity for them to pause and reflect and think, well, maybe there's some additional information I can glean on the website and retain their ballot for a little bit before mailing it. That's my thought. Maybe we should embark on education. Councilmember Clay?
Yes. George, you were much more organized than me, and you had a heck of a following, and I wasn't that fortunate to have a lot of money early on. But I can control myself, and I'm not going to do anything to defame myself. And I just the 460 thing on the web, that's fine, okay. But all this other stuff, who are we afraid of here? I mean, what in the heck is going on? I mean, there's got to be some awful people out there, I guess. That's the only thing I can think of.
That's what the people in Alaska are saying about their state senator. Councilmember O'Malley.
Thank you. I think we still need to be focusing on the negative ads and how to counter that. And I do think, as Councilman Bayrou said, having some city-funded forums where folks have a chance to respond to that, I think, does help level the playing field. I think we have to work hard to, if someone is coming before us advocating for something, it should be treated like anything else. That should be something that's disclosed. Or likewise, if someone is opposing something, everyone has an interest of one form or another, and that should be disclosed if they are influencing, because the fact is it should be under ex parte anyway. I think we need a little bit of a review of what ex parte means. If we're getting any influence outside of a public meeting that is trying to influence our vote, that needs to be disclosed. And so I think maybe reviewing that with folks would help too. And I do want to, we may be going down a path I think is unfortunate, but won't be terrible. I do think we want to emphasize something that Ellen Bayrou and I are sending out to candidates, a letter that we've agreed on, that we need to remind folks that when this is all said and done, some of you may well be elected and you'll be sitting up here, and we're going to all have to work together, and it takes three votes to do something. And if you want to have it done in our community where it stays and lasts through a season, it's much better to have four or five votes, because as we've learned in the past, if you have a unanimous council with the diversity in our community, you're going to get something done that's going to last. And the way you build consensus is not by creating enemies during the campaign season and being fair and being forgiving and a lot of things that we could do better, and hopefully that'll happen this campaign season.
All right. As I mentioned, I support the four issues you put on the plate. And do we have sufficient direction to address them?
Can I just interject here? Councilmember O'Malley was talking about ex parte and expanding ex parte.
I think just following what ex parte
is. That was one of the four things. And so maybe an expansion of that along the lines of what he was saying?
I think if we review what ex parte means. What is the definition? I think folks don't always appreciate that.
Well, that was one of the four things that...
Yeah, we can review that.
We're getting fuzzy here,
Councilman
folks.
Councilman Rubero said, so maybe a discussion of ex parte.
Review it.
Do you have that direction, the four items?
I know there's four things.
Okay.
I have voluntary expenditure limits with incentives, 50 cents per citizen. Is that the direction on that?
Well, if there's a different number, then, you know, that some other city is using, maybe some city more comparable to Atascadero, then...
In terms of size? Okay, I'll research that and tell you what I find in terms of... I know there are a number of cities that have... an amount per resident, and I'll see what the range is in comparable size cities. I've got the late contribution limit is the second item, reducing the reporting from $1,000 to $250. The third thing I have is the ex parte disclosure of contributions of over $250 at a time that a matter comes before a council for action.
Both ways.
Yeah, perhaps that's one thing I need a little more clarification on. What else besides what I just said?
Well, if you support, you know, something, or if you, you know, if you receive money from someone that is opposed to the issue, that should be disclosed also.
But if they don't speak, I mean, if they don't come to the podium, I mean...
It should just be the applicant, whoever the applicant is.
How are you going to know?
I mean, everyone that comes to the podium, we have to say...
Well, you'll never know if no one discloses it, George. Yeah.
No, we're talking about the applicant. We're not talking about everyone who comes to the podium. Well, he's my supporter or not my supporter.
Let's assume that there is somebody in the neighborhood who is opposed, and they don't show up.
But if you receive money from a organization or a person that opposes a certain issue that's on the agenda, then I think you should disclose that.
Well, I can see this.
You're influenced by that person.
Oppose Walmart did not exist when I ran, but let's use them as an example. So basically you're saying any issue involving Walmart that came, I should make the disclosure of how much opposed Walmart gave me.
If they contributed.
If they contributed. I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah.
Same thing. Yeah.
Good. Or any other organization. It might be something else, you know.
All right. I'll see what I can do on that one. The next one is the 460s on the web. Expand that to include mid-year filings. Perhaps I could ask the city clerk if that would create any issues on her end.
Break. So we are at the end of the road on this issue.
We're just starting down the road.
In which case, we should take a break.
Okay, a break's in order. Five, 10 minutes. Let's be back. At 10:25, and hopefully we can maybe knock off the next item. Are we ready? All right. We'll reconvene. And our next item on the agenda, management report, C2, dormant building permit applications and unpaid plan check fee update presented by Mr. Frace, Mr. Warren Frace.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. This item, we want to talk about the status of some dormant building permits and also some unpaid plan check fees that are associated with those permits. Staff's got some ideas about how the city might take action to deal with the situation. And so this is an idea that we wanted to run by the council and get some direction on whether or not the council would like to see staff proceed with this idea at this point. Just in terms of an overview, there's basically two types of building permits, or there's two statuses for building permits within the city. There's the applications, which is when somebody applies for a permit and they submit plans, and then we start a review process. And then there's those that are approved that have been issued that are actually being acted on or being used for construction out in the field. What we're talking about today is basically those applications that are in process. Those are the permits where the plans have been drawn, they're in some sort of review phase, but they haven't been issued. Some of them are ready to issue, but haven't actually been paid for and picked up. So these are all the permits that are still somehow in our office. So in terms of those permits that are in our office, right now there's about 250 what we call dormant permit applications. A lot of those are single-family residential, multifamily residential, commercial, and industrial. So they're either in some sort of plan check phase, as I said, or they're ready to issue. What happens is the municipal code only gives you 180 days to either submit your plans for recheck or to pick them up once they're approved. And what we're seeing now is that because the economy slowed down, there's permits that are ready to issue, but there's no demand to build these projects. So these permits are going to run out of time and expire. There is a one-time extension that's allowed under a municipal code that grants another 180 days. Unfortunately, at this point, most of the applications that are in our office have already exhausted that first extension. So we're starting to see a number of permits that are sitting that are going to run out of extensions, and that's becoming a concern. We know that the economy is not going to obviously recover this by probably this calendar year. It may be a year or two off before we really see a significant rebound in the construction industry. And these permits won't last that long unless we take some action to extend them further. Probably the best example of this right off the top of my head is the Colony Square project. We do have the permits for the theater sitting in our office ready to issue, but they're still working through some of their financing issues. They've already applied for their first 180-day extension. Without an additional extension, that permit's going to expire this month. So this is the type of project that we're looking to potentially give some more life to. The other issue that we have is the outstanding plan check fees. Between 2000 and 2005, the city did not collect a deposit when we took in a permit to cover the plan check fees. We do now do that, but we had some issues with our old computer system that didn't allow for us to account for them, so it was something that we did not do. As a result, we do have a number of these permits that are dormant at this point, where there's thousands of dollars in outstanding plan check fees that are due. And we do have an interest in the city in terms of trying to collect these outstanding plan check fees. So what we're looking at is a concept of providing a one-time extension requirements. It could take a year or two for the new owners to reprocess, replan check, and then get permits ready to pull again. So that's another benefit, is that once it does recover, if these permits can be acted on, it'll speed up the recovery locally. It'll also prevent us from having to go through a whole new review process. We all know and hear that the review process is lengthy, and if we can avoid that by not having to recheck basically the same project again in a year or two, that saves staff time. It also saves the construction industry money. It also helps with housing costs as well. Local construction industry is also one of our key local industries. Clearly, if we can do something to help them out, it will benefit the local economy. And also, this will help improve the city's image of being supportive and helpful to local business. So the staff proposal is to create a new text amendment to our Title VIII building code, which would provide an additional one-time permit extension that would retroactively extend dormant permits. So even permits that are technically expired today, we would go back and capture those. So we would be able to reenact or basically breathe new life into some of these permits that have already expired. This would only cover single-family residential, multifamily residential, industrial, and commercial building permits. We're not proposing that old re-roof permits or patio covers or smaller permits, more miscellaneous things be included here. Those tend to expire for different reasons other than the economic reasons. The proposal is to extend all these permits till December 31st, 2009, which would be about 15 months from today. That date is flexible, so if the council wants to adjust those dates or any of these dates, that's clearly something you could recommend. The requirement would be, in order to get this time extension, the applicants of the permit would have to pay all the outstanding plan check fees that are due to the city. We also would provide some sort of process where the applications and fees would have to be paid by a certain date. Right now we're proposing December 31st of this year. So basically that would give everybody 4 months to apply. We were proposing this originally in June, so we've lost 2 months. We may want to consider pushing those dates back a little bit further, so there's about 6 months probably to apply for your time extensions. So that is our recommendation, is to have the council direct staff to prepare this Title VIII code text amendment and bring that back to the City Council for consideration at a future hearing. In terms of alternatives, you can refer this item back to us for additional analysis and review. There's probably other options we could come up with. If we don't take any action, basically what's going to happen is these permits that are dormant or have already expired, we're going to have to start beginning the process of formally expiring those permits and starting some sort of collection process on the fees. That's kind of where we're at in the process. So that concludes staff's report. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Warren. Councilmember Clay?
Warren, in regards to collections, what percentage do we get?
I believe it's about 60% we get back.
It's a 60-40 deal. Huh? A number of these have gone through the whole nine yards, and they just are not pulling them because of the economy. Is that not right?
Yeah, there's just no demand for residential product at this time. Yeah. Some of these are half-built projects. One example would be Andy Charnley's apartments down on the south end of town. He's built three units so far. He still has to build the other 10, but those permits, if he doesn't pull them, will expire. So this would give that project more time, and then we wouldn't have to recheck it again.
Okay. I'm going to throw out something. I don't think we're going to get recovery in 15 months. I would like to see that extended to either December of 2010 or at least until June 31st, 2010. And I just like to throw that out. 15 months is not enough in this economy.
Excuse me, Warren. Hertel, there's, I think, 20 of these dormant permits that are listed under Hertel, and it's my understanding there's a bankruptcy issue there. Can we still capture those? Are we going to be able to capture those fees?
We believe so. Because these permits and these lots have value, even as they go into bankruptcy, they just will revert to some other new owner, and that owner is going to have the same interest in the economy at this point, but that project will move forward at some point.
Amen.
All right. Thank you. Other questions? Mayor Pro Tem Barrow?
Regarding that, if you have a building permit that is several years old, do we need to be concerned about them being code compliant? Because, you know, codes change over time. What would you consider be a reasonable period of time that should be a cutoff?
Well, we've talked about this internally. There wasn't a lot of structural changes before this year when we adopted the I code. So the last 5 or 6 years basically have been the same code in adoption the whole time. And that was because the state was trying to go through the I-code process. We do now have a new code on the books. It is a different code. It does have different standards, but because it's a blended code for some of the standards for residential, it's actually less onerous than what the current or the older standard was. So in residential, especially single-family residential, I don't think that there's a huge issue in terms of the standard. I think, you know, the old standard and the new standard are fairly comparable. In commercial development, you know, the standards are somewhat different. But I think what we're saying is we're comfortable that buildings that were permitted under the previous code are going to be of high quality and meet the standards.
So you don't think a cutoff is really necessary in terms of the dates?
I don't think that would be necessarily the reason why you'd cut it off. I don't think there's not a difference in how they were plan checked in 2003 or 2006.
Okay. Thanks.
Other questions?
I have one.
Councilmember Luna?
What does it mean when it says placeholder? Like on page...
In the table?
Yeah.
Those were applications that were submitted before the building plans were actually submitted. So on some of these larger projects, they wanted to move quickly to get the project into plan check. They didn't have all the plans ready to submit, so they would submit applications with very basic rudimentary site plans to create a placeholder for the permits, and then we would go through what's called the stock plan review. So you'd have 30 placeholder permits that would then be tied to three or four stock plans that were in a separate review process. So that's typically how we referred to that.
So there are no fees attached to that until they come in with the project that you can review?
Well, the plan check fees were charged against the stock plan rather than the individual lot because we were going to use the same plan multiple times, and then they would pay a reduced plan check fee when they would pick those up. So there are still fees that are due, but they're shown, they're probably clustered under the stock plans, but we'd use the same process to extend the stock plans to collect those fees.
So they are. So in that last column, should that be a ditto, or is that included in a previous amount? See on page 179, right-hand column at the bottom.
Yeah, where it says where there's nothing shown.
Right.
Yeah, there's no fee due at this point. The fee is would be under the stock plan, and on some of these. Those fees, if the stock plans didn't get all the way through the review process, we haven't calculated those fees. We'll have to, if those permits expire technically, we'll have to manually calculate what those fees due are. So some of these are blanks, either because they're not due because they were placeholder permits. Sometimes they're stock plans that we just haven't gone through the formal process of calculating the total fee yet. We can do that. We just haven't.
Do you have an estimate of the total number of, say, single-family residential units that are in here, in this table?
Well, there's a total of about 250 permits or 249 permits total in this table. I would imagine that 220 probably are single-family residential, and then the rest would be multifamily, and there'll be a couple commercial ones in there.
Okay. Thank you.
Mayor Pro Tem Birrell? Oh, I'm sorry. Councilmember O'Malley.
Thank you. Now, I forget on an earlier report, I think we are about, $600,000 or $700,000 shortfall in our budget related to permits, or is that about right, the figure?
I believe that's a pretty close number.
And I'm assuming that this $370,000 plus or minus is a subset of that. That's where some of those, that shortfall is. Or here's $370,000 of plan check fees we increase that would be on our tax rolls. And there's some advantage to getting this jump started when the economy turns around. That there's really a multiplier effect for us in addition to just these fees collected. Is that my understanding correct?
Yes, I would think that's the correct conclusion.
And I'm thinking it might actually help the market out there because there's a lot of these pieces of property sitting out there, and some of their value is whether or not a permit is still valid or not, and it might help some of that financial logjam out there if it's clear that these properties that are sitting out, whether in bank portfolios or whatever new owners, it seems like that would make it more of an incentive to do something if you've got a approved permit versus an expired permit. That's probably more of a Rochelle financial question than a planner commission, but does that make sense that this might help that backlog out there, makes our city's projects more competitive, let's say, compared to another city's if you're in the same situation, competitive bare land sitting out there?
That's been staff's thinking, is that if the permits are ready to go, it'll make it that much easier for the next developer to build these projects. It's complicated enough to get a project going. Trying to, you know, re-permit all your buildings is something that banks and lenders and people like that that might be inheriting a project
right.
aren't really up to the task of doing. So we definitely believe that by keeping these permits active, these projects will be able to finish them off a lot sooner. That's going to be good for the local economy.
Good. Well, I think staff did a really good job on this report, and I think it's a good recommendation.
Councilmember Clay?
Warren, you don't have a problem with extending it a little longer. I don't think 15 months is enough myself.
No, we don't. And like I said, we've lost, you know, a couple months since we thought this original recommendation was going to come to you. So if the council sees fit to change the dates, make them longer, there's no problem whatsoever.
Thank you.
Go to the public.
Other comments? Okay. We'll open it to the public. Is there anyone from the public that would like to speak to this issue? Seeing none, return to the council. And
I'd like to make a motion.
Go ahead.
That we go with staff's recommendation and change the date to December 31st, 2010.
Second.
Discussion?
I'll support that if you change that to June.
That's fine. That'll give it 21 months. Always thought about
second
that, George.
Accepts right. friendly right. amendment.
So we're referring June 2010.
No, 2000 June 31st 2010, or if there's 31 days in June, I'm not sure.
Last day of June.
Okay. All right,
it's
we
30.
Have. We have a motion by help me here.
Clay, second
Councilman
O'Malley.
Clay, second by Councilman Luna.
O'Malley.
No,
I'm
right.
sorry, O'Malley.
They confuse us.
Roll call, please.
Councilman Luna?
Yes.
Councilman Clay?
Yes.
Councilmember O'Malley?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Bayrou?
Yes.
Mayor Brandler?
Yes.
Motion passes 5-0.
Thank you. All right. We're moving. Well, it's almost 11 o'clock. Does council, anyone in the council have any
suggestions? I'd like to move that we adjourn.
I'm tired. I've been up since.
Make a motion.
Four.
It's always an order.
I'm moving that we adjourn.
Do we have a second?
Second.
We have a motion by Councilman Clay, second by Councilman O'Malley. Discussion? Roll call.
Councilmember Clay?
Yes.
Councilmember O'Malley?
Yes.
Councilmember Luna?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Bayrou?
No.
Mayor Brandler?
No.
Motion passes 3-2.
Aren't we glad we got to campaign finance reform early?
Yeah, we got through it. Okay. Yeah.